Good afternoon. I'll call this meeting of the Job Growth, Energy Affordability Policy and Finance Committee to order. Today is Wednesday, March 30th. The first order of business is approval of the minutes. Representative Hortman moves approval of the minutes dated Wednesday, March 23rd. Is there any discussion?
Mr. Chair, pick somebody else. I don't like to move minutes.
All right.
I haven't read them.
Representative Swazinski moves the approval of the minutes for March 23rd. Any corrections, additions, or subtractions? Seeing none, all those in favor, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, say nay. The motion prevails. The minutes are adopted. Members, a couple of housekeeping things. First of all, in your packets is some helpful information that I thought would be members would be interested in regarding energy usage, consumption, and production worldwide. You'll see. It's, thank you. It's the British Petroleum Statistical Review of World Energy. I found this to be very helpful. It's a very good mix of energy from renewables to traditional energy sources. It breaks it off by region, by country, nation, by source. And I would just point to particularly if you take a look in the area of natural gas and coal in the United States and our amount of energy production that's gone down, that's the changes that have taken place through the years. Very helpful piece of information for members to have as a reference point. Second of all is there's a letter that's been distributed. This is a letter I sent to Chair Torkelson. The Capital Investment Committee requested that we refer all the Capital Investment Committee bills to them without action on our part. And so I learned this. Apparently we can do this without any formal committee action. The chair can just write a letter and say all these bills are going there. So we've done that. So if anyone's asking you about hearing capital investment bills in this committee, they are no longer in our possession. They are in the possession of the Capital Investment Committee and should discuss that with Chair Torkelson. Third and finally, we have an ambitious agenda for today. Barring lightning striking, I don't see us getting through all the bills by 2:30 today. So what will happen is that we'll have the afternoon session and then the evening session. Please stay tuned for location and time and reconvening information. But for members, I know that you have a lot of other commitments going on. There's other committee hearings meeting. It's the majority's intent that there'll be no roll call votes tonight or today. Certainly, members of the minority can ask for that. But if you have other committee hearings, you don't need to worry about that. You'll be checked in for attendance and be here. So those are the three things I have. Anything before we move on to our first bill on the agenda? All right, Representative Rarick, the chair moves that House File 29, the first bill on the agenda for us is House File 2992, and the chair moves that House File 2992 be recommended to pass and referred to the General Register. My understanding is the agenda is either getting passed out to members or is in the process of getting passed out, but in your packet, this will be towards the back, again, House File 2992. Representative Rarick, to your bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members. House File 2992 is a Department of Labor and Industry bill. It deals with the AWARE program, the Workplace Accident Injury Reduction Program that's administered under OSHA. It is a program for certain employers that have to establish this safe workplace program. Currently, OSHA is required to update the list of companies that are on this list every 2 years. That has become a little bit cumbersome and creates a few problems. Some companies tend to get on the list and go off the list, and there's confusion sometimes whether they should have to comply or not comply. So the department is asking that we go to updating the list every 5 years instead of every two. It should reduce some paperwork and some confusion. And then while we're here, they wish to delete some old language. When this was originally presented, a date for compliance was listed as July 1st, 1993. That is no longer relevant, so it is being deleted.
Representative Rarick, is anyone opposed to your bill?
Not that we're aware of.
Representative Rarick, does your bill cost any money?
It does not.
Mr. Welcome to the committee, sir. Would you like to testify in favor or voice concerns with this bill? Please introduce yourself for the tape.
Thank you, Chairman Garofalo. My name is John Rakuski. I'm the Legislative Director for the Department of Labor and Industry, and OSHA brought this forward to us as a way to cut down on what is the number's two highest, most frequently cited OSHA penalty. The first, by the way, for those who are interested, is fall protection violations. And we feel that by going to 5 years, we'll reduce the number of violations that they'll have to do and cut down on a lot of negotiations between us and employers.
Thank you. So, Representative Rarick, do you have any other invited testifiers?
Mr. Chair, we do not.
This is a public hearing. Are there any members of the public who wish to testify in favor or voice concerns with the bill? Seeing none, we'll close the public comment portion of the bill and move to member comments and questions. Questions or comments for members of the committee? Representative Rarick, any closing comments?
Mr. Chair, no.
With that, the chair renews his motion to have House File 2992 be recommended to pass and refer to the General Register. All those in favor, please signify by saying aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed, say nay. Motion prevails. Thank you, Representative Barrick.
Thank you.
Representative Knobloch. Members, the next bill on our agenda is going to be House File 3117. So we'll give members a minute to pull that up. The chair moves House File 3117 be recommended or passed and referred to the General Register. Representative Knobloch, to your bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. Members, this is a bill that was brought to me by the executive branch that I do support. It's a very simple bill. It says that the Commissioner of Human Rights is added as a board member to the Urban Initiative Board. And I have here with me the Commissioner of the Department of Human Rights, Mr. Kevin Lindsay.
Welcome to the committee, sir. Please state your name for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Sure. My name is Kevin Lindsay. I'm the Commissioner of the Minnesota Department of Human Rights. Appreciate the chair and the members of the committee hearing this particular bill and the sponsorship of Representative Knobloch. One of the issues which faces us today is creating entrepreneurship and economic opportunities in all communities. In my prior work, I had an opportunity to do so and work with business owners. And my work as an attorney with Oppenheimer, Wolf & Donnelly and Howland Lewis kind of carried over some of that respective knowledge. And it provided that insight to small businesses as it relates to the challenges through the Urban Initiative Board to ensure that loans are made available to emerging entrepreneurs. I think that there is a connection from the statutory language of the Human Rights Act, 16 and 17, the provisions within the Act, tying business and credit opportunities, and the department could use education technical assistance to ensure entrepreneurs are aware of all the opportunities for business development.
Thank you. Representative Knobloch, is anyone opposed to your bill?
Not that I'm aware of, Mr. Chair.
Representative Knobloch, does your bill cost any money?
No, sir.
Is this the completion of your invited testifiers?
It is, sir.
This is a public hearing. Are there any members of the public who wish to testify in favor or voice concerns with the bill? Seeing none, we'll close the public comment portion of the bill and move to member questions or comments. Any questions or comments from members of the committee? Seeing none, Representative Knobloch, any closing comments?
Mr. Chair, members, I'd only say that I think it makes sense to have the Commissioner of Human Rights on this board, and I'd appreciate your support.
With that, the chair renews his motion to have House File 3117 recommended to pass and refer to the General Register. All those in favor, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, say nay. Motion prevails. Thank you, Representative Knobloch.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members.
Thank you, Chair and members.
Okay. Representative Swazinski.
Thank you, Mr.
Which
Chair.
Which one do you want to take up first?
Let's take up 3074. That'd be all right.
Do you have a motion for us?
Yes, Mr. Chair. I move House File 3074 before the Job Growth Energy Committee to be possibly included in a future bill.
Okay.
I believe that's a proper one.
So Representative Swazinski moves that House File 3074 be considered for possible inclusion in a later bill. Representative Swazinski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members. Appreciate the opportunity to come before the committee. House File 3074, really, it's the main gist is to really look at the possibility of the state of Minnesota setting forward some standards for consumer protection across the state. As we all know, with the actions taken by previous legislatures, the solar mandate within the state, we've had a huge growth in the development of solar projects, both at the producer level, but also the community solar. This bill really sets aside, there's been some in the news in the late, just within the month here, early March, there's been some news articles with Minnesota Public Radio and other organizations talking about some of the issues that consumers are dealing with across the state. And what this bill really kind of sets some standards and it does some certification on promotional materials that really talk about, you know, what's the amount of generation can be, what's the chance of repayment, looking at what the projected monthly savings to make sure that those things are actually within the guidelines of reality. There's also a portion of the bill that talks about a certification of a sufficient escrow account, and that really is going to deal with looking at folks' investment because of the unique circumstance that the state of Minnesota has presented the market. Really, when you look at a state mandate, it maybe, I think, maybe plays differently than other portions of the market when there isn't a state mandate involved. And kind of that closeness with the state and also industry. There's also some mechanism allowing subscribers to transfer subscriptions, cancel, looking at how they can get in and out of future contracts, and then how the complaints would possibly be dealt with. So as things come in and how they're dealt with the commission itself. And then also looking at setting aside some, looking at production levels and warranting around those issues. I know there's some folks from the AG's office here that can maybe just talk generally about, not necessarily this bill, but just kind of some of the issues that they're seeing on, and what they're kind of dealing with from across the state. And obviously there's not, I think James Cannaday, if you want to introduce yourself.
Welcome to the committee, sir. Please state your name for the record.
Thank you. James Cannaday. I'm a Deputy Attorney General from the Office of Minnesota Attorney General Lori Swanson. Just to say a few words, I guess what I'd like to cover is any substance in the bill. I'll be brief in my comments, but I can answer any questions committee members have. I'd like to touch on why this is an important topic and then just say a few words about what's going on in other states, because there are a number of other states that are dealing with these same questions. In terms of the substance of the bill, I was invited by the author to provide some comments because the recommendations in the bill are in line with some recommendations that were made by the Attorney General at the Public Utilities Commission about 2.5 years ago. And obviously the solar garden industry and the marketplace has changed in that time. Primarily it's changed because it's now being marketed directly to consumers, and we're hearing from consumers who are now having the issues that we were discussing in a theoretical way a couple of years ago. And so to give a high-level summary, I would say that the recommendations in this bill are in line with the recommendations made by the Attorney General's office about 2.5 years ago at the Public Utilities Commission. One countervailing point I would make is that the process is still ongoing at the Public Utilities Commission, and they are still considering a number of issues with the program, including consumer protection issues. And so to say it's ongoing is a bit of an understatement. Even this week, we're planning to submit comments to the PUC about consumer protection issues again. So I would agree it's appropriate for the legislature to take up these issues, and I can explain why it's important. But I'd also just want to make sure everybody understands it's being considered at the PUC. In terms of why this is important, solar gardens are something that's not familiar to a lot of consumers, and it's a new concept. And so this is a big investment in terms of the dollars that are at stake. It's a long-term investment in usually 25 to 30 years. And these are complex contracts. So those three factors, I think, are the main reasons why the Attorney General has taken the position this is an appropriate area for consumer protections. One thing I would say that we have heard from industry is that self-regulation is an option here. Certainly we encourage discussions, and we would be happy to participate in discussions about self-regulation. But the concern there is that in an area this complex, we can't leave it to self-regulation. There are industry trade groups, for example, that we have had discussions with about consumer protection issues, but there's not mandatory membership in those trade associations, so we can't just rely on membership to protect the marketplace as a whole. So finally, I know we need to keep our comments brief today, so I won't go into detail, but I'd be happy to answer questions. But I do want to point out that just in the last, I think, 2 weeks since the bill was introduced even, there has been a report that is directly on point with the consumer protection issue for solar gardens that's been released by a national group. So there's a 55-page report here I'd be happy to provide to anybody or discuss with anybody that goes into a great deal of context as to why both everything that's in the bill in front of you and some additional protections are appropriate and why they are necessary in this context. Just a couple of words about what's going on in other states. The state of Maryland is currently considering proposals regarding consumer protections in this regard. The state of Arizona has passed some legislation this year on how financial projections can be used in marketing to consumers. The state of Maine is also considering issues this year. So Minnesota is not unique in that regard, and there are a lot of good ideas out there that we can discuss. I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you. Nice. That's the copy of the report you have right there?
Correct.
Oh, would you mind just reading the whole thing to all of us right now? No, just kidding. So if we could have staff get an electronic copy of that, and we'll distribute it to members of the committee. Who published that?
It was authored by, the name is Barbara Alexander. She was formerly the director of the Consumer Assistance Division at the Maine Public Utilities Commission.
Okay, cool, good. Okay, and then the NPR story that you said, Representative Szczynski, that's your handout that is in the packet right here?
Yes.
It's in there, so we should be good to go. All right, did you have other testifiers you invited?
That is the extent of my testifiers for the day that I have invited.
I have two other individuals who have signed up to testify. First, in advance, first of all, Mr. Henkel. Hey, Baker. Sure.
Welcome to the committee. Please introduce yourself for the record.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Lynn Hinkle. I'm the policy director for the Minnesota Solar Energy Industry Association. It's always a delight to have an opportunity to address the members of this committee. I'm here today to, on the one hand, support aggressive, proactive measures to protect consumers in any market, and in particular the community solar garden market that is growing rapidly in our state. I'd like to make three points. Number one, we think that the PUC in its order of April 7, 2014 did a really excellent job of weighing through determining what elements needed to be included, which elements were unnecessary in terms of consumer protection. That document is online. It's available. It was referred to by the previous speaker. And we believe that the PUC did a very thorough job. There are pages and pages of testimony from all the parties, all the stakeholders that have been active in this space, including the AG, the AG's office. And again, we think that the PUC's guidance concerning consumer protection and the disclosures that are necessary are quite robust. The second thing is that we have, as an industry, partnered with a number of folks. In fact, I brought a handout of there's a page that could distribute this. Oh, well, I think I brought enough copies. What you see in front of you, or will very soon, is an effort on the part of CERTS, MNSEA, and the Minnesota Renewable Energy Society to put together what we think is a very thorough checklist that subscribers can use to essentially interview and review contract stipulations. So you'll see the page and a half. It's pretty detailed, and I believe it addresses most of the concerns that are contained in the legislation proposed this afternoon, House File 3074. But we haven't stopped there. We have continued to work very actively, we being MNSEA and other stakeholders that are committed to developing a robust community solar gardens market, to deal with issues as they arise. If you went back to the PUC docket, it's docket 13-867, and looked at the most recent compliance filing by Excel that records the minutes of the last SRC implementation working group, and lays out in pretty great detail what the lines are in terms of how to use, how to incorporate information about Excel, and also about REC payment, REC purchase, REC payment. This is exactly the kind of thing that we think is necessary to prevent misinformation, miscommunication, and we think that this is another example of our being proactive along with Excel in generating clarity and consumer protection for those that are interested in subscribing to a community solar garden. With that, I'll conclude. I think it's clear that we're supportive of consumer protection. We've taken considerable, put considerable effort into pushing that forward, working with the PUC, working with the other stakeholders, and we would urge that you allow that process, those protocols that are in place, and we believe that already address these issues, to continue to move forward.
Thank you, Mr. Hinkle.
Happy to answer any questions about consumer protection in this space or other questions about community solar gardens.
Mr. Hinkle, I think what we'll do is we'll take testimony from the people who signed up in advance, and then we'll open it up to public testimony. Once we close public testimony, then we'll move to member questions. So thank you very much for your testimony. Finally, on the pre-signed up list from Fresh Energy, Holly, is it, how do I pronounce your last name? Ladd, right? And even though I just said it, please say your name for the record so 100 years from now they know who you are.
No problem. Chair Garofalo, members of the committee, thank you for allowing my testimony today. My name is Holly Ladd, and I serve as the director of our Energy Markets Program at Fresh Energy, which is an independent energy policy nonprofit here in St. Paul. We've been actively working with other stakeholders, including the Attorney General's office, other agencies, the Industry Association, and Xcel Energy, on Xcel Energy's community solar program over the last 2.5 years at the Public Utilities Commission. And while we share the goal of creating a process to handle issues related to community solar gardens, we have several concerns about the language as it's presented today. First, as other testifiers have said, the commission already requires 2 pages of disclosures on many of these issues to customers, and that was developed in April 2014. And CERTS and others have taken that order and made it in a really consumer-friendly checklist that we've worked with the Industry Association to ensure that developers are using, so customers really read every detail of this contract. So were this bill to become law, we believe it would not only duplicate many of the processes and procedures that are already in place, but it could also create burden on Minnesota solar businesses in this new industry. For example, I believe there's part of the bill that would require a full subscription refund if the consumer wishes to cancel. It doesn't say what time at which they might cancel that, so there's an option where a consumer could use a subscription for 24 years, cancel, and get a full refund at the beginning of what they paid for. That I don't know of any other product that would require such a refund, as it has a lot of value over the course of the subscription. And we'd like to point out that even though the law creating Xcel Energy's community solar program was passed in 2013, so far only one small garden is actually in operation. And so much of the consumer confusion we think has to do with that this program has been in the news for 2.5 years, and there's a lot of excitement, but because of the delays in the process, particularly interconnecting these gardens, it's no wonder many consumers are wondering, where are the gardens that I'm evaluating? We do believe there's a need for tools to provide basic guide for consumers who are exploring their community solar options. So in addition to the disclosure checklist, a bill credit calculator, frequently asked questions, all of which exist and are available on Xcel's website, developed by CERTS and other partners. At Fresh Energy, we've recently released a consumer-friendly community solar pledge that will establish best practices for businesses and consumers. And I believe we've provided copies for you, or that could be distributed. And we've had many interests from solar developers, and it's taking the pledge to really show not only should consumers read all the details of their contract, but here are kind of some best practices and stamps of those best practices that they should look for. By working with regulators, solar businesses, and most importantly, customers, we've worked to create an independent set of criteria to evaluate those options. And now we are working with the CERTS program, the Clean Energy Resource Teams, and others on a number of events coming up, even starting on Saturday, for customers to meet with solar developers and shop their options. We're calling it solar speed dating, and you're all welcome to come. It's the first one is on Saturday in Minneapolis. Just trying to reduce any confusion out there and really have customers meet with developers, figure out what option works best for them as there are a variety of business models being explored, and they have pros and cons to each. So in conclusion, our goal is to help ensure consumers have the tools they need to navigate this new and growing community solar industry, and we thank you for your time.
Thank you very much for your testimony. And I was mistaken, there is one other person who signed up to testify in advance, Julie Jorgensen. And my apologies, you did sign up in advance and got missed. So welcome to the committee, and please state your name for the record.
Thank you, Chair Garofalo, members of the committee. My name is Julie Jorgensen, and I am the CEO of Greenmark Solar, and we are a locally based sustainability company, and we develop innovative projects to drive examples of sustainable innovation. Our most recent project is under construction right now at the Minneapolis-St. Paul Airport, the solar installation on the roof, which will, as of today, is the largest solar project in the state of Minnesota. I am here today, I think a letter is circulating now, on behalf of several members of the community solar community here in Minnesota. The developers who've signed the letter include Novel Energy Solutions, Solar Stone Partners, Sunrise Energy Ventures, True North Solar, Innovative Power Solutions, Cooperative Energy Futures, and NRG Energy. And I'm here to give you the benefit of our input on what the impact of this bill would be on the community solar industry here in Minnesota. And I won't read everything in this letter verbatim, but if there's something that's not in this letter, it's not the entire industry speaking, only myself. So just with that distinction. Our first comment is that there have been 3 years of delay since the Community Solar Garden statute was implemented, and this has nearly derailed implementation of Minnesota law. Only one very small solar garden has actually been built. XL filed its plan to implement the state statute of 2013 at the end of 2013, and the final commission order actually implementing the program took place in January of this year, 2016. I decided not to cut down trees in the name of solar and print the 24-page list of all the documents filed in the solar docket, the community solar docket. You can find it on the Department of Commerce's website. It's docket 13-867. Hundreds of millions of dollars have been invested by private industry in this program since 2013. Of the 2,000 megawatts of projects that were proposed, XL estimates that fewer than 200 will now actually get built, and a lot of this is due to the kind of war of attrition that the regulatory delay and uncertainty have caused. I'd like to start by saying this bill surprised me because I've participated in the XL working group that was mentioned by the previous testifiers, and nobody has brought a consumer protection concern to the working group. This is comprised of every possible stakeholder, including XL and the Attorney General's office. Our understanding is that based on how the market is performing, consumers are protected, and I just want to go into that a little bit. But I think it's very significant that legislation is being proposed that the industry's really not been made aware of the kinds of concerns that this legislation is designed to take care of. First of all, the market's fragile, and all the market participants know that the acts of one affect all of us. So we are all very interested. All the developers who've signed this letter are very interested in making sure there's transparency and that there are no consumer problems with the program. I guess my first thought on the legislation is that a competitive market for subscribers has already emerged that ensures compliance with the full disclosure requirements of the original 2013 statute. And the 2013 statute requires that all of the risks and benefits of a community solar subscription be fairly disclosed. What's happened in the marketplace is as the finance parties come in, the tax equity, the lenders and their lawyers, and they start to scrub subscriptions for underwriting these projects, if we haven't complied with that disclosure requirement, which is basic, the project does not get financed. Okay. So there is a mechanism, and that's the marketplace at work. The bill, as proposed, provides for very significant regulation and includes Excel in the process. And this regulation is in substitution for what I believe are judgments and balancing the interests that are already at work in the marketplace. First of all, the proposed regulation is designed to address a very little used cooperative subscription model that almost no one is using, which is the prepaid upfront subscription. Mm-hmm. What's happened in the marketplace is consumers and companies and towns and school districts have said, I don't want to pay for power that isn't delivered. So the subscription agreements of all of the companies listed on here, with the exception of the co-op, which does have one prepaid model, is if you don't deliver electricity, you don't get paid. So there's no need to protect consumers with prior regulation of what those terms and conditions are, because that is what the marketplace requires. So much of the bill is aimed at that model, which is not even the current model for community solar gardens. Just taking an example, requiring that all subscription contracts must be cancelable completely limits market choices and makes most projects completely unfinanceable. These are 25-year assets with, in many cases, 20-year loans. And if you say, and it's really, if you look at the model, is it sort of in lieu of putting it on your own rooftop, which is a 25-year decision? In this case, it's a better model. The consumer doesn't have to take the risk that the panels produce or go after the warranty. But the idea that after you put solar panels on your roof, you could cancel that contract somehow halfway through is not financeable. I've mentioned that involving Excel in the process is an extraordinary provision, giving an Excel, certainly not Excel's mission, to stimulate competition or innovation, and allowing them a direct role in the regulation of their tiny competitors would be unprecedented. I'd like to close by saying additional delay, I can categorically state, will be fatal to the CSG program and will completely thwart the implementation of the 2013 Community Solar Garden Statute. The very first CSGs, and I can understand why our customers are unhappy, where we've signed subscriptions and then years go by while the regulatory uncertainty and the wrenches thrown into the program get resolved. Of course, consumers are starting to wonder what the heck is going on. We are finally at the point where the very first CSGs are going to start construction. We've gone through engineering, permitting, in a very, very difficult interconnection process with Excel, financing, and we're just getting ready to start construction. This bill puts all of those projects back at the beginning, starting over, and subjects it to regulations that would have yet to be developed. I think the letter was distributed by an earlier testifier, the checklist. Mm-hmm. We believe that's adequate. We believe that the commission has adequately protected consumers and had extensive hearings on this subject, and we think that further legislation directing very burdensome, significant new regulatory processes be implemented is a shot right in the heart of the program and Minnesota law. Thank you.
Thank you very much for your testimony. Are there any other members of the public who wish to testify in favor or voice concerns with the bill? Come on down. Unless you're with Rebecca Peichel, in which case you're not allowed to testify. Welcome to the committee. Welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Cliff Kaler, I'm the CEO of Novel Energy Solutions. I want to start by saying, I think you'd be hard-pressed to find anybody in the solar industry who disagrees with the intent of this legislation. Fully agree we need to protect consumers, need to make sure disclosures are clear. It's not good for our industry when consumers are caught unaware. That being said, the CS landscape has changed drastically in the past 2 years, and the legislation as written is going to significantly adversely affect consumers and the Minnesota economy. First thing I want to focus on is the change in the models, and I'll go quickly since Julie covered some of it, but with the pay-as-you-go change, from the previous upfront models, the risk is transferred from the subscribers to the financiers and the garden owners. When that garden's built and they're subscribed, we've invested the upfront capital. We need 25 years to get our return, and we take production risk. If the garden doesn't produce, we don't get any money. Whereas the subscribers, because of the market forcing the pay-as-you-go model, they have $0 invested up front. If there's no production, they're exactly where they are today, and they get savings each month from their garden. A few sections specifically to that I think are cause some issues. The biggest one is Section 14, the production requirement guarantee, which on a prepaid model, I think there's, it's a conversation we can have. There's some merit there. But on a pay-as-you-go, it makes the garden unfinanceable, because what happens if, if you were projecting 1,000 kilowatt hours a month, but you have an off month, an inverter goes out or something, and you get 500 kilowatt hours. The issue for the financier is, they're now short of their return, 500 kilowatt hours, but if they have to guarantee 1,000 kilowatt hours to the subscribers, now you're in effect doubling any shortfall of production, and you're guaranteeing the subscribers immediate, savings even on gardens that don't produce. So it's
walk me through that again. I didn't follow that.
Oh, sorry. So if you have to guarantee production, mm-hmm. So say the projection is 1,000 kilowatt hours a month.
And it's cloudy, so it just doesn't come.
Yeah, okay. Something happens, and so it's at 500 kilowatt hours that month. Well, while the subscribers were basing their revenue on 1,000 kilowatt hours, so let's say it's 10 cents a kilowatt hour is the rate, so now instead of getting $100, they're only receiving $50. But if they had to guarantee the subscribers that they were going to generate 1,000 kilowatt hours, they would then have to make a $50 payment to the subscribers to make up for that shortfall in production.
Okay.
So it's effectively a double effect. Section 11, the escrow, again, prepaid model, there's some merit there. Whether it's an escrow or a corporate guarantee or some sort of guarantee that the company will be around for 25 years to service the garden. But with the pay-as-you-go, the escrow is the annual payments that the subscribers pay to the garden. And then Section 12, the cancellation. My brother just bought a house. I think he would, love to have the option to cancel his contract at any time, but, it doesn't work with houses. I think, again, it's what we have right now is a well-crafted plan. We've had a lot of input from the Office of the Attorney General, the DOC, the PUC, a lot of subscriber advocate groups, solar developers, and it took us almost three years, to get the first large-scale gardens going. And right now we do have the protections that are similar to the other industries. They can go to the OAG, the Department of Commerce, when there is a complaint. Is it good that the OAG is getting some complaints? No, it's not. But it shows that there's recourse for subscribers when something is not going as planned. Section or numbers 10 and 15, the PUC's done a great job in trying to handle this, but for them to have to review all of the marketing material and all of the documents of every community garden subscriber, I can't imagine how long that would take. Just with our company, it's taken us months and months to pull everything together to get it to final form. So the third thing is, this will stunt some of the economic development that these gardens are bringing to Minnesota, especially some of the rural areas. We're talking hundreds of millions of dollars of investments, local jobs. Every time these gardens are built, that's local construction jobs. The savings they generate for the consumers get reinvested back into the local economy. And then there's land rent to the subscribers, or sorry, to the garden owners, or landowners. I want to close with, I agree. The goal is we need to protect consumers from bad actors. 100% agree. But I think rather than regulating the entire industry, what we need to do is bring the hammer down on when people are caught being unfair, unscrupulous in their advertising practices. I think you'd be hard-pressed to find anybody in the industry who is against that. And, you know, rather than just saying things I don't like about the bill, I want to say that there's, like I say, I think our intents are the same, and I have some ideas, I think, that might solve both of the problems. So the talking with consumers, the biggest issue we've heard is when they're, you know, unclear on whether it's a termination fee or an escalator. And, you know, these contracts are long, they are complex. They have to be for a 25-year asset. So what I think, you know, if we're going to legislate anything to protect consumers, what would be the simplest, cleanest, and most effective way to do it is just require every community garden operator to put a one-page disclosure at the front of their contract stating the key economic terms that impact the subscriber. So have them state, what is the termination fee? How does it apply? What is the transfer fee? What is the rate they're charging? What's the escalator? And a way to protect people from them using Excel rates that are, you know, aggressive, I'll call it, is just mandate that say, hey, on this one page, the Excel escalator has to be, you know, 3% or whatever percent it is. So it's the same across all developers, and then say, well, you know what, the final number is their savings over 25 years. This way, any subscriber can take a look at that one-page document and know exactly what are their financial risks. And then this way, you know, it simplifies the program from the PUC and the commission having to approve all the marketing documents to just saying, hey, here's the one-page document that shows all of the key terms, and make it something so that there's no way the subscribers can miss it. Thank you.
Thank you. Just a quick question. So, first of all, as always, with any stakeholders, we're laying this bill over. So if you have suggestions for corrected language or improved language, as always, please continue to communicate with the author as we move forward with this process. So you made some pretty convincing arguments about prepaid plans versus pay-as-you-go plans. Would you see that if we had a separate disclosure structure for those items, would that be helpful?
I think it would. You know, the prepaid ones, I'll call it, are a little more complex. And I don't want to necessarily... I think, in terms of disclosures, absolutely different standards. I will say that we still have some customers who want prepaid. You know, they see a prepaid and say, hey, I'm going to get, 7% return. I've got money sitting in the bank that I'm never using or in a CD. So I think...
But as always, consult a financial advisor before making any decisions,
yep,
right? Yeah, okay.
Exactly. So I think that, my thoughts are 95-99% of the market are the pay-as-you-go. So I think getting it clear for that and then moving to the prepaid after that, you know, rather than trying to do everything in one swoop, the pay-as-you-go is where, that's where 99% of the market is. So making sure that those disclosures and whatever it is we're doing is clear there, I think is going to solve almost, every issue that could come up. It's not going to solve everything, but, that's where I think the effort should be, is on the pay-as-you-go.
Thank you very much for your testimony. Are there any other members of the public who wish to testify in favor or voice concerns with the bill? Welcome to the committee, sir. Please state your name for the record.
I'm Ralph Kaler. I may be coming with a different generational aspect of this situation, but I'm friends with George. I'm not here with Rebecca, so that separates us that way. We got to give her a little grief when we can. But part of most of my testimony is in support of my son. A couple of things that I wanted to point out on this before we start. Cliff's the fifth generation on our family farm and started the company. But to give you a little more oversight on the people who are coming back to this industry, we have three Georgetown University graduates that have joined our team. One's from Connecticut, one from Massachusetts. Two of our guys have Wall Street experience and gave up those jobs to come work for our company. One's got a master's degree from Yale. So the people we're pulling back to our state and the talent to develop these gardens, and particularly in a rural community, I think is a very unique situation in our industry and particularly in agriculture as I see it. These bills that are here, as I told Representative Swedinsky, we're in favor of ensuring consumer protections. I think it's valuable. Having the DOC have our contracts so they have them to review is a good idea. But I think we also have to be careful. With this bill, we're adding an additional layer of government and an additional layer of bureaucracy that is somewhat redundant. I don't think that's the focus of anybody in our government from what I read. The other thing with this bill, there's good intentions, but a lot of unintended consequences. particularly item number 12, the cancellation. I think it's been addressed a few times. I can't imagine any industry that would allow a contract to get a cancellation at any time, particularly a 25-year contract, and get a full refund. I'd like to buy tractors that way for our farm. It would be a great deal, but I don't think I would find anybody that would sell tractors or houses with that kind of oversight. It doesn't make sense. It's an unintended consequence. It will make our gardens unfinanceable. The third thing we want to make sure as this bill goes forward is the understanding of the industry. The pay-as-you-go, the prepaid formula is basically only being used by our rural electric co-ops where they own the gardens. We need to make sure if they're doing that, that fee up front, that they're regulated by it. Right now, this bill is only for public utilities. Our fee and some of the language and most of the garden, it is no fee up front. They save purely by their subscription. The way number 12's written, if someone leaves, if we followed your language right now, and it wouldn't be the intent of the bill, an unintended consequence, those consumers would owe us money back when they leave because they didn't pay anything up front. It would be the savings they collect over the 10 years and leave. We don't want that, and I don't think the committee would with this bill neither. The fourth thing, we need to reinforce our focus has been rural projects. If this bill moves forward, it would kill projects in the big towns of Butterfield, Minnesota, Tyler, Minnesota, Minnesota Lake, Mapleton, and Osakis. We have private landowners, family farmers, and small communities that are very excited. Each megawatt is a $1.5 to $2 million project that's bringing money to those communities. It's not just the metro area we're dealing with. These towns and communities are incredibly excited about having this new influx of capital. We call it Minnesota growing electricity. That money, everything there is generated in Minnesota, the tax base stays in Minnesota, and everyone within the surrounding county that subscribes has a chance to save money. We don't want to hinder that progress. The third, or the last thing I would point out, some items that should be of greater concern than maybe the consumer protection is the progress of these projects. We've got three situations where the utilities are preventing private landowners from building these gardens because they have an imaginary line where they split the property and it's their territory. If we want to talk about land rights and owner rights, to me that's a big deal. We have to move our project off of territories based on an imaginary line that a public utility and an REA have. That's not the way our land ownership or the intent of the law was meant to be. We have one community we were told we cannot upgrade the substation to put in solar because they'll have to shut that down for 6 to 12 hours and there's no other way to service that town with electricity. That should be of considerable fear for us. How many of our small towns have no backup because of the utilities? I don't believe that's true. I believe it was a way to kill a community solar garden. But that should be of utmost concern if this small town, if their substation goes down, they don't have any other way to get electricity. That is not right. So either we've got a bad line from our utilities, or we've got a serious issue out there. And we've got 3 years with no major project being built yet. We do have the first one done. It's 40 kilowatts, owned by a family next to their hog barn. We have two others built that are waiting for interconnection. The 250 kilowatts at a hog farm in Tyler, Minnesota. We started in April. We're still waiting to get that meter on. It's not that we're not trying, but we've been fighting delays. We get hurdles. We're working the best we can with them, but your support to help enhance the program would do more for our consumers than adding extra layers of bureaucracy and paperwork for subscribers on their gardens. Again, thank you for bringing this up. We want to make it very clear, we are all in support of a fair contract, but we don't want consumer protection discrimination for subscribers. If we're going to go to this level of things for a community garden subscriber, we need to do it for my son buying a house, for me buying a tractor. But we understand what would happen with those rules if we did that. Thank you.
Thank you. Are there any other members of the public who wish to testify in favor or voice concerns with the bill? Seeing none, we'll close the public comment portion of this bill, and we'll move to member questions. Mr. Kennedy, if you could come down. There were some concerns brought up in the public testimony. Do you have anything you wish to address regarding the language or thoughts about it?
That's a wide question. Yes, I can make some responses to the testimony that I've heard. I'll respond first to something that was just said. I mean, I think the comparison to buying a house is an apt one because I think that's part of the point in support of consumer protections. Community solar gardens are similar to the concept of buying a house, of taking out a mortgage, of dealing with your retirement fund on those three criteria that I discussed before, which are significant amount of money, significant amount of time, and complexity. And there is significant regulation in all of those other areas, in buying a house and taking out a mortgage and choosing an investment. There is some regulation, very limited consumer protection regulation, in the area of consumer community solar gardens, but we think there should be more. So I think that is an apt comparison, but I would draw the opposite conclusion of the last testifier, I guess. That said, some of the criticism offered of this bill, I think, is valid, and so I want to address that, too. I am giving a nuanced answer here in terms of the bill. I think there could be some improvements made to it. We support the concept of increased consumer protections, and as I said when I testified, the specific consumer protections listed in here do track what the Attorney General's office recommended 2.5 years ago. Several people raised a distinction that has developed in the last 2.5 years, though, and that is the change from the pay up front model to the pay as you go model. 2.5 years ago, the recommendations were written assuming that these were all going to be pay up front models because that was the state of the art, I guess you would say, at the time. Pay as you go does seem to have been a more recent development and something that seems more prevalent in Minnesota at the current time. And I do think that there could be some improvements made to the language to deal with that. But let me tell you why I think pay as you go doesn't fix our problems. Even if you have a pay as you go situation where somebody is not putting down $10,000 or $50,000 or whatever it may have been up front, what you still have is a consumer being asked to sign a contract agreeing on what they're going to pay for their power. That's a complex decision right there, speaking as somebody who deals with regulating electricity markets and utilities every day. I would hesitate before I agree to what my price was going to be for power. But you are also agreeing to what the annual escalation rate is going to be, for example, over the next 25 years. You could certainly have a hearing, for example, where you asked people who did this every day to come in and talk to you about what the electricity market's going to look like in 25 years, and you could get all kinds of answers. It's a very complex topic, but I don't think anybody would be guaranteeing that they'd be right about their guesses. But we're having consumers lock in what they're planning to do for their electricity pricing for 25 years. That's why it's serious. Now let me back up and also make clear, this can also be a good thing for consumers. It's not that the solar industry is bad. It's not that they need regulated in a way that other industries don't, but it's because of this complexity that we need to make sure that the consumer protection is there so that consumers have the full information, they can make an informed decision, they can understand the assumptions that have been made when they're comparing what they're being offered versus the projections they're being given for what their price would be with their existing electric company to compare it to. Right now, there's certainly a level of obscurity that's possible in all of those projections and all of that information, and I think there's a lot of room of improvement. This bill offers some. It could also be improved.
So basically what you're talking about there is that we don't know what the price of electricity is going to be in 5 years, let alone 25 years. And so building in an assumption, building in an assumed inflator could be very beneficial to the consumer. Or it could end up really screwing the consumer.
Yes.
We don't know.
Both options are possible, and more information.
As I said, it could be disadvantageous to the consumer. I shouldn't have used that word. So, but I mean, it could go either way. Is your point
correct?
Okay. All right. And then Ms. Jorgensen, if you could come down, I had a quick question. And maybe, Jim, from the Attorney General's office, if you want to say your comment. So when a person, obviously when a person has infrastructure put on their, where is Ms. Jorgensen? Oh, she's going down, okay. We'll just wait. So when a person has a rooftop solar unit, obviously that is a fixed asset that is part of their home. A community solar garden, that's not the case. So if a person sells their home and they leave out of the state, I mean, how does that cancellation procedure work right now under current law and under current agreements? Because it would seem that neither the buyer nor the seller would have the capability of fulfilling the contract.
Mr. Chair, members of the commission, there's very little rooftop activity right now in Minnesota, but where a consumer decides to put solar on their own roof and invest in it and finance it themselves, it either improves or does not improve the value of the house that they're selling. But there's no third-party source of financing. I mean, I'm sure that if there's a loan for the solar facility, that could be assumed, but I'm not familiar with the structure of that market or...
Right, but that's like it's ingrained in the property. It's a, you know, it's like a deck. But with regards to community solar, if someone moves to another state, it doesn't seem like either the seller or the buyer has the technical capabilities of fulfilling that contract, because you can't sell electricity to someone who's in another location, or your business can't, and the buyer can no longer purchase it because they're in a completely different regulated service territory. So in that situation where someone who has a community solar garden leaves, let's say they move to Michigan, mm-hmm. what happens under current law? What happens under the current contracts?
Mr. Chair, members, it depends, and it's contract by contract. I think most consumer contracts allow, if you're moving out of state or out of XL service territory or out of the territory, the counties that can be served by the solar garden allow for cancellation. In most of the commercial contracts or with cities, corporations, that's something they have to take into account. In our case, our subscription agreement says that if a subscriber wants to cancel, we'll work with them to try to find a replacement subscriber. But they are making a long-term bet on that they're going to be in their facilities, and they're weighing that. I would say that is something that I, in the actually review consumer contracts on behalf of friends and neighbors and relatives, and I've seen a lot of the people participating in the residential markets materials, and I would say that's an upfront and center disclosure in all of their contracts, again, because their sources of financing require that.
So it really depends upon the individual contract then, because there's a situation where 10 years from now, a person could be moving, and the rights to sell that the remaining years of that contract could be very lucrative. If electricity rates have skyrocketed, and this person's got a contract for 15 remaining more years at this very low rate, that's an instrument of value. Conversely, there can be a situation where if maybe the inflator is too, vice versa, where that's a liability. Does the owner... So it depends upon the contract, whether the owner retains that value or whether the developer retains that value, or if the owner retains the liability or whether the developer retains the liability. Is that just a contract-by-contract basis?
Mr. Chair, that's correct.
Okay.
Yes.
Okay, thank you very much. Questions from the committee? Representative Fabian, and is it for this testifier or for another one?
Yes.
Okay, so Representative Fabian.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Ms. Jorgensen, thank you for being here. I have a question, a clarification more. I think you said in your testimony that people don't pay for electricity until it's delivered. Is that correct?
Ms. Jorgensen.
Mr. Chair, Representative Fabian, that's correct.
Okay.
Representative Fabian.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, then, just for the committee and to that point, in the news article that was handed out here on the second to the last page, the person who had signed a contract and they were spending money, they found out that the garden hadn't even been built yet. So unless I'm reading something wrong, and I'm not saying that belongs to your, that's a result of your company, I'm not suggesting that. I'm just saying that globally it seems that maybe some of this is happening, and and maybe there is a place in legislation to make sure that that doesn't happen.
Mr. Jorgensen, is there value in, as we, and again, and convince, encourage all stakeholders to work with the author, to work with the Attorney General's office in terms of correcting language, but is there value in having separate standards for the pay-as-you-go versus the upfront model, the prepay model?
Mr. Chair, from our perspective, the current statute and the implementing commission order adequately address all the consumer protection requirements in the statute.
Understood. Mr. Henkel, did you wish to add something?
I wanted to respond, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, to a concern that has been raised by the AG's office, and even in this testimony today. We believe that if there are concerns, and apparently there remain concerns on the part of the AG and those lawyers, that there are issues that need to be resolved that were not resolved in the order that was issued by the PUC. That, for us, is the mechanism, is the arena for these questions to be resolved. We think that they were adequately resolved, and to be quite honest, we're a little bit surprised because the AG's office has declined over the last 9 months to a year to be a part of the process to resolve these issues. We'd have been more than interested in hearing those issues brought up in the SRC implementation working group before we see a piece of legislation that comes forward. We think those issues could have been addressed in that context. We think that's still possible, and we'd encourage the committee to embrace that process and look very carefully at introducing something that essentially, in our view, undermines protocols that have been put in place by the PUC, the Department of Commerce.
And again, let me just remind members and testifiers, obviously this is a very new area of law, not only in Minnesota, but also nationwide. It's very complex, and so these are just some bumps in the road that are going to happen, but I would, again, encourage stakeholders, the author, and the Attorney General's office to continue these conversations. You wish to add something, Ms. Jorgensen? Oh, did you wish to add something or not?
Oh.
You were reaching for the mic like you were going to say something.
Yes. Body language, thank you. Mr. Chair, members, the only other point I wanted to make is the industry has a lot of, when we play the game, there ought to be a law. There are lots of things we'd like to see changed with the statute and with the implementing tariff. Our perspective as a group across the board is introducing new legislation that requires commission hearings and implementation is an 18-month to two-year delay of the program. So what we ask is, let's see which of these projects proceed. There are anti-fraud laws in the state of Minnesota. There is oversight of how you deal with consumers, and we think if there are additional mechanisms in the case of the ones where you prepay, which from my understanding is a very, very small part of the market, we can have that conversation. We think we can have that at the commission and the Department of at the AG level without further legislation. The one thing I'd like to see as a disclosure matter is you all mentioned that nobody knows. We have full disclosure with Excel spreadsheets to our subscribers of, based on different assumptions, what their savings or costs will look like. But the piece we're missing, and Excel has declined to provide it, is where does Excel project their rates to go in the next 25 years? So we are taking historical information and trying to tell consumers and companies and towns, look, the last 10 years look like this, but we don't know because we don't have access to strategists, and Excel has trade secreted kind of the trajectory of where their rates are going to go. We can't tell you that other bookend piece of information so you can evaluate this. We can only give you different scenarios under different assumptions. So if I was, and I don't need legislation to accomplish this, but I would love to see that number produced and put through a commission process by Excel. Thank you.
Representative Johnson, then Representative Mahoney.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and there certainly does seem to be room for compromises. Representative Swedinsky moves forward with the bill Questions of testifier. There's one solar garden now, as I understand. How many do you anticipate over the next few years? I'm not getting a sense how big a problem this is or how many gardens we can anticipate.
Mr. Jorgensen, or Mr. Henkel, I'm sorry. Who is it for?
Representative.
Mr. Henkel.
I appreciate the question and give you the information that was submitted to the PUC in the latest compliance filing from the SRC at Solar Rewards Community Implementation Working Group. There's a report that's issued in each of those meetings about the status of applications, where the projects are in the process. We had roughly 2 gigawatts of applications about a year ago, and according to the report that you can read, it's online, we've now winnowed that down to about half. About 1,000 megawatts of applications have been withdrawn. So that leaves about another gigawatt in the process, and of that, we've been told that about 530 megawatts are moving through the design construction phase. That doesn't mean that they're at construction, but they're moving towards that. We anticipate that of that 500 that are in that pipeline or in that phase, that we'll see in the neighborhood of 200 megawatts of community solar gardens on roughly 100 sites throughout the state within the next year.
Representative Johnson. Representative Mahoney.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I was wondering if the Attorney General's office could come down.
It appears he can. Whether he will or not, I don't know. But it looks like he is. All right. So, Representative Mahoney.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My question, it's been brought up that the consortium or the group has been meeting for over the past year, and the Attorney General's office has not been participating. So I'm wondering if the Attorney General's office could comment on why they haven't participated to bring up these particular concerns if they were there.
To the testifier.
Yes, Mr. Chair. Happy to respond to that question because I completely disagree with that characterization. We have participated in this issue heavily over the last 2.5 to almost 3 years, which is the entire time it's been in existence. Every single issue that we're discussing today has been recommended in extensive written comments, and I would estimate that means between 40 and 50 pages at least of prolonged discussion of these issues at the PUC. They've been debated by the PUC. The issue is that the PUC declined to implement a number of these protections. And so the industry is certainly well aware and has been for years of everything that is being recommended. So that's one piece as to the issues. As to the working group that was raised by Ms. Jorgensen and Mr. Henkel, the Attorney General's office has participated in that work group on the consumer protection issues. The only distinction I make there is the work group deals with a number of issues. There are a lot of other areas besides consumer protection, which deals with co-location of these gardens, implementation of the rates, all kinds of other things. We have not played a large role in that. But any time that the consumer protection issues have been discussed, we have participated in that work group. And I would say, you know, Mr. Henkel told the committee that we've declined to participate. We met with Mr. Henkel last week on these issues. He requested a meeting and we talked to him about it. So I don't think you had a full picture before. That's my side of the story, and we're happy to participate in this issue going forward. And I mentioned earlier, but we're filing comments this week on consumer protection issues at the PUC. So,
Representative Mahoney. All right, so I don't want to get into any testifier versus testifier violence here, but if you, looks like you Miss, you wanted to add some additional comments. And
yes.
Then I have a follow, oh, I'm sorry. And we have, do you mind if we go to Representative Fabian first, and then we'll?
Whichever way you want to respond.
All right, so Representative Fabian, because I have a question too. So Representative Fabian.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just a couple of quick comments for me. One of the testifiers talked about there was recourse already available. I'm sorry, I don't remember who that was, but they said that there's legal recourse. I haven't really been involved in legal recourse, but my sense is that when you get to that, the consumer is kind of boxed into a corner, and that may become
prohibitively expensive in some cases. My good friend, Representative Smith, we joke a little bit about what his hourly rate is and whatnot. I'm not sure that I could afford that. So I just want that to be on the table as a part of the discussion that's coming.
Let's address that point, Mr. So what is the current process of resolving a conflict? Is it like cell phone contracts where sometimes there has to be binding arbitration, or is it really just the rules of the contract that dictate it?
Yes, Mr. Chair and Representative Fabian. I would say everything the Chair just mentioned is a possibility. That's going to be a contract-by-contract issue. There is going to be legal recourse available to the individual, which comes with the expense that was mentioned in the question. One of the earlier testifiers also raised the point that if there's a problem, the Attorney General's office has whatever tools are available to it to deal with it here. And I, you know, for the sake of time, I didn't respond to that, but I will now. We do. There is obviously the normal consumer fraud, deceptive trade practices, false advertising statutes that would apply in any context that could come into play here. But the issue is the Attorney General's office is not going to have that option available until a problem is widespread enough to be a problem that is something that we're aware of and that we know to start looking into. And that's precisely the concern when you have the contracts that involve a great deal of money here. That is part of why the recommendation is for additional consumer protections and regulation up front to make sure that the problems are headed off before they occur.
Representative Fabian, do you have another question?
I do, Mr. Chair. Thank you. And then I think it was Mr. Hinkle that handed out the little checklist and so forth. I don't know. Does this have any legal standing? Is this something if it's attached to the contract, is it a separate document? Where is this? And I guess my comment would be that if we're willing to do this as an industry, I would think that maybe they might be interested in heading off some of the other issues that may arise by having some more assurance on the front end.
So this is mandated by the PUC, right? Or to either of the testifiers? I mean, this information is required by the PUC right now.
Yes, Chair. That check is a consumer-friendly checklist of what is exactly in the PUC's April 7, 2014 order in this docket. So it's just making it more accessible than in this giant document.
Thank you. So my question was, so with regards to the contracts right now, what are the current legal requirements for length of contract? Does it have to be 25 years, or is that the longest it can be? And if neither of our testifiers know that, is there someone from staff who can answer that for me?
Chair, I can say that the contract between Xcel Energy and these gardens is 25 years. So that is clearly regulated. The PUC does not regulate the contracts directly between subscribers and developers. But if the asset only has a contract for 25 years with Xcel Energy, I just simply cannot imagine you would have a contract longer than that, because the bill credit would not be applied since the contract with the garden ends at 25 years.
Because you had additional, before I ask my last question, you came down to kind of offer additional information. Why don't you do that before I ask my final question, and then we'll go to member comments before we move on. Please.
Yes, and I don't want to get into a battle of who's been at the work group or whatnot, but again, we have been participating in 2.5 years, and the Attorney General office did bring up these issues in the hearings that led to the April 7, 2014 order. And as the industry has evolved, more issues and conversations have raised, and there have been, I believe, probably two or so work group sessions just on consumer protection, but these issues are coming up, and the Attorney General is listed explicitly in the PUC's order as a party of the stakeholder group, but other than a handful of means they've chosen not to pay, is my perspective.
Okay. So my question, and then we'll wrap this up and move on to our next bill, unless there's any other questions from members, is that that situation I laid out before where we have two hypotheticals, one where retail electricity rates skyrocket going forward. We have another situation where rates just remain relatively flat based on an infinite number of factors we can't calculate. But there's a scenario out there where this rental contract, this contract becomes extremely valuable and lucrative, but the subscriber, the citizen, is forced to pay the developer to get out of their contract to transfer this asset so that the developer actually cashes in three times. They sell it on the front side. They sell it when it's transferred, and then they get to resell it a third time when rates are much higher. Now, the flip side to this is that everything else can be the exact opposite, where rates are flat, and there's risk there, but it seems like what I'm hearing is under current law, these contracts, all of the risk is going to be in those situations, and whether the prices go up or down is borne by the retail consumer, not the developer, entirely dependent upon the construct of the contract. So I guess for each of you, am I right or am I wrong? And if I'm wrong, correct me. Just tell me why I'm wrong.
Yeah, there's a couple different business models emerging in the pay-as-you-go market, which, again, is the vast majority of these. One is that this, you get the bill credit rate, whatever it is, at the time of generation, and that is regulated by the Public Utilities Commission, that's what the consumer gets. It's the agreement they have with the developer that could be different business models depending on the garden. One is you pay a flat percent rate for the length of the contract, say 10 cents. So any costs or savings are that delta between the 10 cents and whatever that bill credit is. Mm-hmm. Another model we've seen is it's always tied to what the bill credit is. So maybe it's the cost that you bear is 1 cent less than the bill credit. That's another model we've seen. Others are that fixed rate, but with an escalator that could be about inflation. It could be based on, again, this assumption of what happens to electricity rates in the future. And there is data out there, as Ms. Jorgensen said, about the historical data. We can get better data from Excel to help inform customers on that, and I believe that they have been working with developers to help package that as much as they know at this time. But those are some of the business models out there. And again, the required disclosure clearly says all of the terms and conditions, both for early termination and conditions of service, and what may happen during the course of service are all required to be disclosed. So the Clean Energy Resource Teams has a very user-friendly Excel spreadsheet that has that historical average retail rate increase, which I believe from the U.S. Department of Energy, Energy Information Administration, is about 3.7% over the last 15 years or so. So that's public. And then you can change the assumptions on the future and the different types of the subscription agreements to show that sensitivity. So there is some risk borne in that. From our perspective, all that information that's available to consumers provides the most that they can have at this time, and nothing in this bill helps address that question that you pose on what that risk could be in the future.
Mr. Candidate, did you wish to add anything?
Mr. Chair, I guess my kind of higher level answer to that question is that you're potentially right in terms of it at least could be that way under current law. There's nothing stopping the answer from being that the consumer bears the risk in all those situations. I think it is true that an individual garden operator could choose under current law to have differing contract terms, but I think that one of the consumer protections that should be discussed here is that issue of risk, and either disclosing that consumers are taking on that risk or changing who's going to bear the risk in the situations that have been mentioned, which are, you know, we've been discussing in terms of moving, but there are all kinds of things when you're talking about a 25-year period that could necessitate these types of transfers becoming necessary.
Okay. Well, thank you. And just so you know, in the chair's perspective is I am very inclined to like the argument about just have the government leave us alone and we'll figure this out. But this is a new and emerging business, and there's a huge potential here under certain situations where people could really get strapped with some serious liability, very akin to what happened at the end of the 2000s and the home mortgage issues. So, but I'm Representative Swazinski, do you want to offer any closing comments before we close out the debate on this bill?
You know, I thank you, Chair Groffler. Thank you, committees, for hearing it. I appreciate the comments from both sides on this issue. I think it's come to light. You know, we've got some work to do. I think there's some maybe looking at the pay-as-you-go portion and maybe carving out and looking at how we can address some of those issues in a separate manner. But we do appreciate it, and we appreciate working with the parties involved.
And all the stakeholders, please reach out to Representative Swazinski as well as the Attorney General's office. Thank you, Representative Swazinski. Next bill on the agenda, we're going to take up Representative Lean's bill.
I got to run.
Representative Lean, are you still here? Come on down. Members, this is House File 2728. And the chair moves House File 2728 for possible inclusion in a later bill. Representative Lean, welcome back to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, committee members.
House File 2728 is a $500,000 appropriation to the small business development centers across Minnesota, specifically for business transition and succession planning. Business transition and succession planning is largely connecting existing business owners who have proven to be successful but may be looking toward retirement or moving on to other endeavors with new and expiring entrepreneurs. This is important as information provided by the Small Business Development Center states that over the next 10 years, 60% of businesses will change hands. Business transition and succession planning, it's important to connect those existing business owners with entrepreneurs looking to run their own businesses and own their own businesses. And this $500,000 appropriation would keep local Main Street businesses open for the next generation. And on a side note, the legislature did appropriate $500,000 to the small business development centers across the state in the 2014 session. And with that funding, the small business development centers were able to help 3,300 small business clients. That's up 9.5%. They were able to raise $130 million in new private sector capital, which is up 30%. They were able to aid in the creation of 226 Minnesota businesses, which is up 13%. I do have a letter also from the Twin Cities Metro Independent Business Alliance in support of this bill. And Mr. Greg Bergman from the Small Business Development Center at Central Lakes College also made the trip down to St. Paul to testify and lend support to the bill.
Welcome to the committee, sir. Please state your name for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Mr. Chairman, committee, my name is Greg Bergman. I'm the director of the North Central Regional Small Business Development Center located at Central Lakes College. Thank you for asking me to speak today. Minnesota Small Business Development Centers, often known as SBDCs, are a partnership program between the U.S. Small Business Administration, the Minnesota Department of Employment and Economic Development, and regional partners such as Central Lakes College. We provide information, training, and advice to small business owners and individuals who want to start or buy a small business. In a typical year, we provide approximately 30,000 hours of consulting services to over 3,000 registered clients. And Representative Lean referred to a handout that would be in your packets that talk about the services that we offer. These services are provided through 9 regional centers in Minnesota. And their outreach offices. Our largest client segment are small business owners, generally 20 or fewer employees. That's typically who we serve. Representative Lee mentioned we had received special appropriation funding in 2014, and that really helped us not only leverage additional federal funds, but to really serve our clients, additional clients, and provide additional services and try some new things that we weren't able to do so without those funds. House File 2728 represents an effort to expand our work with business succession planning. Succession planning was an area in our region that we made an effort to expand with that special appropriation provided a couple years ago. Entrepreneur Magazine last fall quoted a CNBC survey which indicated while 78% of small business owners intend to sell their businesses to fund their retirements, fewer than 30% have written succession planning. So they go on to quote that this is not a recipe for success, and that's how we see it. A lot of our work in this area, a lot of our interest in this area came from working with buyers who were attempting to buy a business and finding out that the sellers themselves weren't prepared to sell the business, which created problems financing the purchase and a number of other problems as the business owners were looking at transitioning that business. Mr. Chairman, the bill before you will allow SBDCs to assist, I'd say, approximately 80 small business owners with succession planning and help us build capacity to continue this project into the future. SBDCs rely on funding like this, as well as other grants and donations, to do the work we do. We believe this is a good investment for Minnesota's small businesses. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Representative Lane, do you have any other invited testifiers?
Not anybody, unless they want to come forward on their own.
This is a public hearing. Are there any members of the public who wish to testify in favor or voice concerns with the bill? Seeing none, we'll close the public comment portion.
Mr. Chair, it looks like we do have somebody coming down.
Well, come on down.
Yeah.
Good afternoon. Welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record and proceed with your testimony.
My name is Mary Majors. I'm with Majors & Quinn Booksellers. It's my family's business in Uptown Minneapolis. And we've been in business for 20 years. I work with my father. And although I know this bill doesn't apply to family member to immediate family member succession planning, we are looking at whether or not I will take over or we perhaps will sell it. And I know from experience that this is a long process, so maybe not a steep learning curve for those of us that have been in business and are used to figuring out things ourselves, but it sure is a long one. And so any type of help in that regard would be great, I think. We go to disparate places, organizations, trade associations, individuals to get information. But if there was one stop that we could connect with buyers even, that would be great. I don't know of any development centers here in the Twin Cities, so I'm not sure where they'll be. But I appreciate you taking a look at supporting small business as an important part of our economic livelihood and health of the state as well as our communities. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Is there any additional members of the public who wish to testify in favor or voice concerns with the bill? Seeing none, we'll close the public comment portion of the bill and move to member questions or comments. Representative Mahoney.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and for the comment. And to the last testifier, your local small business development, to the Ms. Quinn.
Oh. You can
your local small business development center is at the College of St. Thomas.
Oh,
and if I sound a little bit prejudiced, I think it's one of the best ones in the state. I was the chief author of the $500,000 allotment to the small business development centers. It's one of those strange groups that actually, for those of us who've been around for a while, we get people that come in and say they're going to sell, they're going to do the move heaven and earth and do all sorts of wonderful things with their monies. I will say I've been following these particular groups, and they sorely underestimated. They really overreached with their $500,000 spread throughout the nine centers in the state. And although we do have a lot of good investments that we can make as a state, this is one of those good ones that we should look at if the chair has the money. If we do a supplemental bill, this is something you should look at, Mr. Chair.
And a question for either staff or Representative Mahoney. The definition of economically disadvantaged communities in paragraph 2, can anyone give me some clarification on that, where it says 80% of statewide median household income, but it also references census tracts, and so I'm wondering Representative Lean, if you can provide guidance on that language, like who would include and who it would not include?
Well, not... Mr. Chair, not so much the technical aspects of the definition and everything, but the bill does say it may be targeted to those areas, so it's not necessarily mandating prioritization.
I missed that. Okay, thank you. Any other questions or comments for the author or for the testifiers? Representative Clark.
Just a quick question. Are these just for for-profit businesses, but also does it include non-profit businesses?
Representative Lean, or the testifiers?
I'll go ahead and answer that, Mr. Chairman. Small business development centers, our primary focus is on for-profit small businesses, and small businesses is defined by what the U.S. Small Business Administration defines as small businesses. That said, again, our target market are those smaller small businesses that typically can't afford private succession planning assistance. We do have the option to work with nonprofits. We typically do that on an exception basis or with kind of special permission from our state office folks, that type of thing. We typically haven't had a problem doing that, but our focus is on for-profit small businesses.
Representative Vogel.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just to follow up on Representative Mahoney, I've had experience with the SBDC at now the University of St. Thomas. It was a College of St. Thomas when they took people like me, and now at the university. I think it's an excellent program, and having worked with small businesses all of my life, I can see the value of transition planning well in advance. So I agree that this is a really good thing that we're doing.
Thank you. Representative Lean, any closing comments?
Mr. Chair, members, I appreciate your time and attention on the bill.
Thank you. With that, the chair renews his motion to have House File 2728 laid over for possible inclusion in a later bill. Thank you. Representative Loon. And Representative Neuberger moves that House File...
Drop. Solid work with you.
House File 2989 be recommended or passed and referred to the Committee on Taxes. Representative Loon, to your bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. As you may recall, one of the components of the Jobs Omnibus Bill last year, and thank you very much for your support, was creation of something called the MINVEST program. And this program is, if you think of crowdfunding websites, has actually created a program where Minnesota companies could have Minnesota investors learn about companies and offerings through a portal on the internet and make investments in those firms. So that program was authorized. The regulations have been, as I understand it, developed by the Department of Commerce, and I just learned today that those regs have now been sent to the governor's office, so we're a step closer towards having that program operational. But this legislation before you today would allow investors in a MINVEST company eligible for the angel investment tax credit. And that is it. And I do have a testifier who is actually one of the architects of the MINVEST program, so if you have questions about that and knowledgeable about our various angel investment tax credit programs with me, Zachary Robbins with Winthrop and Weinstein.
Representative Loon, is anyone opposed to your bill that you know of?
Not that I'm aware of.
Representative Loon, does your bill cost any money?
No, Mr. Chair.
All right. Welcome to the committee, sir. Please state your name for the record and offer any testimony you wish to offer.
Thank you, Chair and members of the committee. My name is Zach Robbins. I'm an attorney at Winthrop & Weinstein, and I'm a member of the board of MINVEST.org, which is a 501c4 that was created to advocate on behalf of this law. I'm here today to talk about the MINVEST law, which is currently pending final rules from the Department of Commerce, but once effective will allow Minnesota companies the ability to raise capital online from Minnesota residents, from both accredited and non-accredited investors. The purpose of this amendment to the Angel Investment Tax Credit is to expand the eligible exemptions under the Angel Investment Tax Credit to permit the MINVEST exemption to become the fourth type of security or transaction to be eligible for credit under the Angel Investment Tax Credit. I provided a chart which you may have in front of you, which outlines the three current ways in which an investor can receive credit under the Angel Investment Tax Credit program. And at the bottom half of the page have identified the MINVEST exemption in attempt to show similarities with the above three types of exemptions. In the interest of time, I'm not going to go through all four types of exemptions, but I would be pleased to answer any questions that you may have on this issue.
Thank you. Representative Loon, do you have any other invited testifiers?
I do not, Mr. Chair.
This is a public hearing. Are there any members of the public who wish to testify in favor or voice concerns with the bill? Seeing none, we'll close the public comment portion and move to member questions or comments. Representative Mahoney.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I have a couple of questions. Can anyone tell me what the dollar figure left in the Angel Investment Fund is at current time? Because primarily it was being emptied within the first 90 days, and if we're adding more to it, does it... I'm just wondering if we're going to empty it in 60 days rather than 90 days.
My recollection is that statute is expiring, but I could be wrong. Representative Loon, or to the testifier?
I'll let Zachary. I think right now the fund total is about $15 million, if I recall correctly.
Thank you, Chair and Representative. Yes, the Angel Investment Tax Credit is set to sunset at the end of the year. I know that there is ongoing legislation to attempt to continue that tax credit for a long term. With respect to the amount that has been sold in the first 3 months of this year, my recollection is that about $4 million of the 15 has been sold. I don't know that for sure. As you may know, there are the fund is basically split into two, and then come September, whatever funds that have not been spent in greater Minnesota are allotted back to the fund. With respect to the question of allowing more investors, certainly more non-accredited investors will have access to take advantage of the tax credit. It has been shared with me that about 95% of the tax credits are going to accredited investors presently. However, going forward, if MNVEST becomes the fourth type of exemption under the angel investment tax credit, only a small portion, in my opinion, of those investors will be able to receive credit under the program. This is because the MNVEST program caps a non-accredited investor's investment at $10,000 per offering. Meanwhile, the angel investment tax credit minimum is $10,000 per investment. So there's only going to be a very small portion of investors who are maxing out under the program who are also eligible to receive the tax credit.
Representative Mahoney, any follow-up?
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair, and that was the testifier in part answered the second question. Having been involved in the crafting of the angel investment tax credit, it was really crafted to high-income individuals who have access to the financial wherewithal to sustain that risk. So I get a little nervous when we expand this to non-accredited investors that may not have that that level of sophistication on investment, particularly in angel investment. That's one of the highest risk investments you can make. 70 to 80% of those people lose almost everything. And I know of at least two people who came up and thanked me profusely because they got to write a $10,000 check. And I looked at them and I said, I know you barely made it into that number. So that's a risky business for 10 grand, but that was their money, not mine, so I didn't care. But now if we start opening this up, I have some concerns, and I'll follow through on that and have a conversation with the author and the chair.
Ms. Hendricks, did you have some follow-up information you wanted to share with the committee?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, per DEET's website, so for 2016, $15.5 million was made available in credits. $7.5 million of that was set aside until the end of September 30th for minority women-owned businesses. As of March 21st of this year, $7 million remains available for these businesses, for these minority and women-owned businesses, and $4.3 million remains available for general businesses. So.
Representative Loon, any closing comments?
No, Mr. Chair. I just think this is a logical step and will make, again, help to encourage the MNVEST program and the many small businesses who would be able to raise capital that they need to get their businesses off the ground and offer opportunities to those investors.
With that, Representative Neuberger renews his motion to have House File 2989 recommended to pass and refer to the Committee on Taxes. All those in favor, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, say nay. The motion prevails. The bill is adopted. Thank you, Representative.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
All right, members, we've reached the end of our time for the afternoon session. We are going to be in recess until the completion of the joint hearing on the IRRRB. You can plan on us reconvening here about 10 minutes upon the completion of that, or about 7:30. Again, we'll be here in room 10. I assume someone has this meeting after this room after clean up. So the materials that you wish to save, please take those and include them in your folder so that staff can grab them. If it's left out, they'll be assumed that you don't need those materials. Representative Mahoney, do you have some there?
Just the question is, where is the joint hearing? Is it in here or
room 10?
Right here.
Yep.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Chair.
With that, members, we are in recess to the call of the chair. Good evening. We'll reconvene this meeting of the Job Growth, Energy, Affordability, Policy, and Finance Committee. Today is Wednesday, March 30th. Representative Szczesinski, we're going to start with you, House File 2240. Or were you not ready?
Oh, I'm fine.
All right. And Representative Keel, are you here? Okay, you're on deck.
Good
Representative Szczesinski moves that House File 2240 be considered for possible inclusion in a later bill. Representative Szczesinski, to your bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members. House File 2240 is a fairly straightforward bill, looking at creating the position of a property rights ombudsman at the Public Utilities Commission, and really dealing with property owners when there's the construction of new projects, whether it be dealing with right-of-ways for line systems or generation plants or whatever that may be. This bill kind of is probably the product of an issue that we had within my district a year ago, and continue to dealing with a large solar project where a lot of the local property owners felt that they were potentially didn't have the voice that they felt they needed, and really felt kind of with their hands tied behind their back. And this made me think of this as a potential to kind of help folks, you know, kind of a nonpartisan, non-sided person, just to kind of allow people to know what options are there, help to guide them through the process of what their rights would be as landowners, and that's what the bill does.
Thank you, Representative Szczesinski. Is there any members of the public who wish to testify in favor or voice concerns with the bill? One down, Mr. Wolf. Representative Mahoney, do you have a quick question while the testifier is coming up?
Yes, Mr. Chair. Just kind of a word of advice to the author. On page 2, line 8, you're talking about legal options from this ombudsman. That means that we're giving legal advice as a state, and you might want to rethink that, because that could get us in a lot of trouble.
Sure. Thank you, Mr. Representative Szczesinski.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. I think when we refer in 2.8, the legal options, I think that just says that these are options, not necessarily these are what you should take, I think.
Welcome to the committee, yeah. Sir. Please state your name for the record.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members of the committee, Dan Wolf, Executive Secretary with the Public Utilities Commission. My testimony is merely to provide the committee with information, so a context for this conversation. And if the committee decides to advance with this proposal, I just wanted to make you aware of the situation at the commission. The commission has recognized for the last several years the need for a member of our staff to help the public negotiate the process and also inform them about what is going on with proceedings and what the options are. We've created, probably about 4 years ago, the position of a public advisor. And in many respects, the duties of the public advisor that we have currently match up with the language in this bill. I won't read the entire job description because it's 7 pages long, as one suspects with a state job description, but I just want to point out the two main categories. One, develop and administer a program for informing the general public and affected stakeholders about the Commission's decision-making process for energy facilities requiring Commission approval. We've got that at 35% of the position. And the second one that's listed also at 35%, so the top two priorities of this position, serve as the primary contact person responsible for public concerns / inquiries regarding cases before the Commission that attract significant public interest, particularly those related to facilities permitting. So we certainly recognize the good role that can be played by public staff helping the members of the public navigate this process, because it is new and difficult for people who have not worked with it on a regular basis. The other thing I should mention is that when this position was created a number of years ago with the former executive secretary, the decision was made to put it in the Consumer Affairs Office because it's dealing with the public. And just recently is when I took over as executive secretary, I reorganized the staff in a number of ways, but one of which was to shift this position into the Energy Facilities Unit, because the public advisor does have roles in rate cases and other proceedings, but primarily it is energy facilities work that this position would do. So again, if the committee decides to go forward with this, we do have a fiscal note in, just because it's not completely duplicative of the work that's being done by this position, but I just wanted the committee to know that we have recognized the need for this type of role, and we do have a person on staff that is designated in that regard. And I would echo, actually on my notes, I did have the same note that Representative Mahoney pointed out is that giving legal advice, again, I think the committee should consider that. I would expect that this position would not be filled by an attorney. Mm-hmm. So we don't want anybody engaging in the unlicensed practice of law. And it is a neutral. It is a neutral position, and we don't want the party misunderstanding that somehow we're representing them or advocating for them, because it is, you know, everything that we do is a quasi-judicial body. We need to be impartial.
Thank you. Are there any additional members of the public wish to testify in favor or voice concerns of the bill? Seeing none, we'll close the public comment portion of the bill. Move to member questions and comments. Representative Susinski, any closing comments?
Thank you. I appreciate the opportunity. I look forward to working with stakeholders on the advancement of this bill. Thank you.
With that, Representative Susinski renews his motion to have House File 2240 considered for possible inclusion in a later bill. Thank you. Representative Mahoney.
Mr. Chair, is the intent of all these bills this evening to be laid over for possible inclusion in an omnibus bill or of some sort of bill like that or something? Are we voting on any of them?
The only bill we're voting on tonight is the Keel bill. I'm sorry, and then the Baker bill. The propane, the House File 3251, that's the Baker bill, and then House File 963, the Keel bill. Those are the only two that I see us voting on.
So, Mr. Chair, if most of these bills are going to be laid over, it might be advantageous for the chair to remind the audience that most of us have been here since 7 o'clock this morning. And brevity would be really appreciated.
I think you just did an outstanding job with that, Representative Mahoney. So
that's for the chair.
Thank you. I learn at your seats, Representative Mahoney. So Representative Keel moves that House, or the chair moves that House File 963 be recommended to pass and referred to the Committee on Transportation, Finance, and Policy. Right? Yep. So Representative Keel, to your bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members, I appreciate the opportunity to hear House File 963. Chair Garofalo, we do need to pass the DE1 amendment.
All right.
To get it into its shape.
All right. So the chair moves House the DE1 amendment and House File 963 to get the bill in the form that the author would like. All those in favor, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, say nay. Motion prevails. The amendment is adopted.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Keel, to the bill.
House File 963 is a bill that came to my attention when my local telecommunications company came to me. They were having challenges preparing to install a fiber optics on a line that would serve a small community, but actually a quite growing community. It would give them better internet service for their city hall and businesses that ran parallel to a rail tracks. As you will hear from my testifiers, the length of time to get permission to install this, along with the cost, we were able to work that particular issue out.
No, we cannot.
But the cost created some issues, and since then I've had more conversations. So with that, I will let my testifiers explain in more depth.
The committee, please state your name for the record.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, my name is Brent Christensen. I'm the President and CEO of the Minnesota Telecom Alliance, a trade association that represents 42 independent telecommunications providers. I understand we get extra points for being brief, so I will not read my comments. I will just say that my members deploy broadband in very rural parts of Minnesota. When we parallel miles and miles of public right-of-way, and then we have to cross a railroad track at some point in time. When we do that, we directionally bore 5 feet at least underneath the railroad track. So we're talking about no diminished use of railroad facilities. And we're seeing charges that, in the example that Representative Keel gave you, it started off at $72,000 for 20 years, and they negotiated it down to $9,000. And that was just to feed the city hall in Fawston, Minnesota. I have another example where we have one MTA member that paralleled a railroad bed for 365 feet and received a bill of $27,000. And it wasn't even a railroad use, it was a bike path. So this is way out of control. We need some help to fix this problem, and we need this so we can deploy broadband in rural Minnesota.
Welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record.
Mr. Chair and members of the committee, my name is Tim O'Leary, and I serve as the general manager of Lion Lincoln Electric Cooperative out in rural Lion and Lincoln counties out in Tyler, Minnesota. We serve approximately 3,500 members by 1,600 miles of line. And last year we had a 5-mile project, of which about 175 of that was our crossing underneath the railroad track. We ended up starting this project in June by contacting the real estate agent for the Rapid City Pier in Eastern Railroad. And we started the process in June. They started at a price of around $4,000 to do a bore underneath their line. We had an existing three-phase line underneath that. We were replacing that. And so we started at $4,000, and then they wanted an additional $600 per year forever. We said that was a little too much. Our project actually started outside the rail right-of-way by 10 feet on one side. We bored underneath their railroad tracks by 14 feet, and then we came up 110 feet on the other side of the railroad tracks. So we thought it was, we didn't really diminish any of the value that of the railroad there. And so we continued to work with them through June, July. We tried to work some more with them. Ended up being August or September, we finally heard back from them, and we ended up settling on a value to be able to finish the project. We actually took us about 5 months from start to finish before we actually were able to finish that last 175 feet. So we think this is an issue. We have several miles of line like we would like to replace in some of the railroad crossings, and we think this will be an issue in the future. So we'd like the support of the committee to pass this bill.
Thank you. Welcome to the committee, sir. Please state your name for the record.
Mr. Chair, Jim Horan, Director of Government Affairs at Minnesota Rural Electric Association. I represent the 45 distribution and 6 generation and transmission co-ops that serve the state. I prepared testimony, but in light of the comments by Representative Mahoney and others, I'll keep it very, very brief. And the chair, I'm sorry, Representative Mahoney. In the less than a year, I guess, since the end of last session, I've helped about a dozen of our co-ops out with this rail issues. As examples like Mr. O'Leary mentioned from Lyon Lincoln, this has been an issue for co-ops going back quite a while, and it keeps coming up and keeps coming up. So I would appreciate your support on this and be willing to answer any questions that the committee may have. Thank you.
Thank you. Representative Keel, did you have any other invited testifiers before we go to the other side?
Let's go to the other side.
Okay. Thank you very much, each of you, for your testimony. So now we want to hear from those with concerns over the bill. So if you can come on down. Good evening, and welcome to the late night session of the Job Growth, Energy, Affordability, Policy, and Finance Committee.
We are delighted to be with you, Mr. Chairman.
Welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chairman. My name is John Appitz. I'm with the law firm of Messerly and Kramer. I represent the Minnesota Regional Railroads Association, which is an association of the 21 railroads that operate here in Minnesota, the 4 class ones, the big ones, and about 15, 16 smaller little railroads that operate in various different parts of the state. They're called the short line railroads and have shorter bits of track and haul lesser amounts of stuff. These railroads have all been responding to these questions for years. They've been responding to requests for crossings and for linear or longitudinal runs for lots and lots of years. We haven't had lots of problems with this. You heard a couple of horror stories here, but we haven't had a lot of problems with this in the past. This bill arose last year, and we tried to have some conversations over the summer. That really didn't work out so well. Maybe we can have some more of those. But we just think there should be a better way to resolve this issue than passing another law. We passed a law about 20 years ago that allows utilities who have a question about the cost that is involved with the railroad, the cost involved with putting in a crossing or a longitudinal running, and that's been in place for some time. There's a matter pending before them right now. That's Minnesota Statute 237.04. You can look it up. It's a procedure that's in place. I'm not sure why we need another one to come forward, unless it's perhaps to give one group an advantage over another group. And that's basically what this particular legislation does. It gives the utilities the ability to use railroad property with basically a bit of notice, some insurance, and a minimal amount of, and a minimal fee for the privilege of using the railroad property. If we don't like it, we can have some conversation about it, but the ultimate resolution is the Public Utilities Commission, which is the place that railroads don't typically go. But don't take my word on this, okay? Let a couple practitioners, people who deal with this regularly, who are involved with this, tell you how currently we do this how it works, and also explain some of the problems with the bill. With me right here, if I may introduce them, Mr. Chairman, is Ann Kennedy, who's a private practitioner here in St. Paul, who does a lot of real estate work for the Union Pacific Railroad and has done that for 20 years. And over here on my right is Commissioner Bob Fox, who's from Rendell County, and he is a member of the Minnesota Valley Regional Rail Authority, the consortium of railroads that operates the Minnesota Prairie Line down in southern Minnesota. So if we could just turn to them briefly and have some conversation, I ask Bob if he wouldn't kick us off.
Welcome to the committee, sir. Please state your name for the record.
Mr. Chair, committee members, I'm Bob Fox, Windville County Commissioner, and I chair the Minnesota Valley Regional Rail Authority. The 94 miles that we take care of is publicly owned railroad. It makes up from the counties of Carver, Sibley, Renville, Redwood, and Yellow Medicine. In 2004, our permits generated $131,000. Our expenses were $95,000. That year, we had $47,800 worth of expenses just in drainage benefits to our local county drainage systems that our rail goes over. In 2015, we had $149,000, and our expenses were $115,000. If we would follow this bill, we'd collect $750 three or four times a year with a budget of $3,000 or $4,000. That won't work. In this House bill, it refers to Chapter 237. The legislature formed the Rail Authority under Chapter 398. And if you read in Chapter 398, Subdivision 5, and I quote, it says, "The authority may establish charges and rentals for the use, sale, and availability of its property and service, and may hold, use, and dispose of, and invest, and reinvest income, revenues, and funds derived therefrom." So my question is, a rail authority, are we part of this, or do we still stay with 398? Thank you for your time today, and I hope you can agree with me to oppose this file.
Thank you very much, Commissioner. Welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members. I'm Ann Kennedy. As Mr. Abitz said, I'm a private practitioner. I've been outside counsel for Union Pacific for quite a few years. I do their real estate work here and in Wisconsin. Much of my work, or some of my work over the years, has involved utility crossings. I wanted to take just a minute of your time tonight to tell you from our perspective, this utility crossing system isn't broken. For Union Pacific and all of the other railroads, I expect, there are careful procedures that have been put into place. One can find those procedures on the internet. They are public. They have been evolving over the years. Union Pacific and the other railroads are in the business to move goods, to provide transportation services, and don't want to be involved in these fee disputes. They coexist with utilities, and they want to get along with them. That's just good, practical business. Here's why I say the system isn't broken. I wanted to just tell you quickly three aspects of Union Pacific's crossing application procedure. First of all, Union Pacific has put in place voluntarily a 30 to 45 day time period to process these applications, and they follow their guideline. Union Pacific also, another aspect of crossings, an important aspect, is the engineering aspect. Soil stability, the stability of tracks, requires that boring, whether directional and otherwise, are done according to industry standards. There is an industry organization, it's called AREMA. That stands for the American Railway Engineering and Maintenance of Way Association. The standards followed by railroads are not arbitrarily imposed. They are pursuant to industry standards and necessary to protect railroad safety. Most of the anecdotal information that you heard tonight had to do with fees. I can only speak for Union Pacific, but I can tell you, and you can confirm this if you want to look on Union Pacific's website, there are two types of fees railroads charge. One is an application fee, and that just isn't for pushing paper. It's for very carefully documenting railroad records and maps to be sure that they know where these utility facilities are, and so that when other utilities come in or there is work done on the track, they know and protect. They know the location of the facilities and protect the facilities. There is also
inspection crossing, both before, during, and after construction, and then, of course, the person who actually receives and processes the application. I don't remember if I said, but that fee for the Union Pacific is $505. There's another fee, type of fee, and that's for property rights. Railroads most often have fee ownership of their right-of-way. And just like farmers, when utilities cross their farmland, their agricultural land, Union Pacific believes that there is diminution in value. That diminution in value depends on the nature of the utility. It depends on where the crossing is located. It depends on other factors like what else is around the location. For Union Pacific, they value these property rights by doing before and after value appraisals, standard appraisal methodology. In speaking with the person at Union Pacific, and there's one who processes all these applications, the other day he told me that the average property right fee is $2,000. So these $27,000 sounds like a lot, but of course I'm not familiar with what else was going on. But I tell you all of what I just did just to reinforce our impression and perception that the system isn't broken and doesn't require a fix. John mentioned that there is, in fact, a statute in place. That's 237.04, and that statute provides a careful process for, in that case, the Commissioner of Commerce to resolve fee disputes. I know of one particular matter that is currently winding its way through the department. In that process, different from the process suggested here, if a utility believes that a fee is too high, it petitions the department. The department sets an administrative hearing. Evidence is taken. Appraisal evidence is gone through, and a just and reasonable fee is established for that particular crossing. There isn't a standard crossing fee. There are some preemption concerns insofar as the bill gets into engineering standards or the placement and installation of crossings, and I won't belabor that, but as you all probably know, the Surface Transportation Board at the federal government has near exclusive jurisdiction over issues involving railroad safety and operations, which installation and energy and engineering issues would often fall into. I think I'll end just with this. There are a few points, if the bill is advanced, that the railroads, at least my client, would very much appreciate a chance to input. One is the amount of the fee. As for reasons I've already talked about, the standard fee concept seems unreasonable, and perhaps an idea of a range would be something to be considered. Railroad protective liability insurance is necessary. Commercial general liability policies don't cover losses that result from construction within 50 feet of railroad property. AREMA standards need to be considered. Finally, under the bill, there is no fee whatsoever for crossings that go through public rights of way. This provision ignores the fact that no matter whether you're talking about a public street right-of-way or another type of crossing, there are still going to be expenses for processing applications, revising maps, for inspections. Also, and finally, for many streets, public street crossings, the public entity doesn't have ownership interest in that crossing. Railroads often were in place long before cities and streets came into being. So very often the public street is not owned by the public entity. I really appreciate your time tonight. Thank you so much.
Thank you. Are there any other testifiers who wish to testify in favor or voice concerns with the bill? Seeing none, we'll close the public comment portion and
thank you,
member
Chair.
Questions and comments. Thank you. Any questions or comments from members of the committee? Representative Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I would just comment, I think it's a good bill to provide some reasonable balance to this right-of-way issue, so I appreciate Representative Keel bringing it.
Thank you. And from both sides that we heard from on this issue, on a scale of 1 to 100, what is the likelihood that you will be able to reach a non-legislative agreement to, like, stakeholder peace in the valley sort of agreement on this issue without the legislature getting involved? whoever wants to chime in with a number. If no one wants to offer a number, that's fine too. But just for this chair's guidance. There's no right or wrong answer, just your gut feeling. Write down your answers on a piece of paper.
All right, I'll see what these guys got to say.
No,
no, it's their bill.
Sir, please.
Mr. Chairman, I would love to tell you it'd be 100%, but we've been at this for many years, and so I would say 10 or less.
Mr. Appitz.
Mr. Chair, I would agree. 10 or less, this, as Mr. Appitz mentioned, we did attempt to get together last summer and didn't get a response. And I'd also note that we've been dealing with this from the co-ops for well over 20 years, and it has increased exponentially over the last 5 to 10.
Mr. Appitz, what's your number, 1 to 100?
Mr. Chairman, if you're taking odds...
I'm not going to be betting on it, don't worry.
Okay, that's good, that's good. Because I know you're pretty good at this. I'd give you maybe a 40-60 likelihood of getting something done.
Okay. So, I mean, pretty deep-seated disputes from the stakeholders, just different sides. I appreciate everyone's transparency. We'll go to Fabian, then Mahoney, and then I think we'll be wrapping it up. Representative Fabian.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, this is an ongoing discussion that I've had with both sides of the issue, and quite frankly, I'm disappointed that we've come to this point. It would have been better for everybody involved if we would have been able to get to some sort of an agreement. That being said, this involves more than just utilities and so forth. It also involves some of my local watershed districts. I met with those folks today, and we hashed through an issue where our crossing was very difficult. I do have one question about the appeal process. The testifier, she said that if a utility feels that the costs are excessive or whatever, there's a potential for appeal. On some of these smaller projects, though, the cost of the appeal, from my perspective, knowing what little I know about billable hours, would probably be prohibitive to even pursue that. So you just kind of wave the white flag of surrender and you pay the assessment as billed.
To the testifier, so the question with regards to that...
the cost of the appeal.
Cost of the appeal in a small-scale situation.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. Gee, I don't know what the cost of appeal would be. I suspect it would be between $5,000 and $10,000. I don't know, but
okay.
Depending on the complexity of the case.
Yeah. Representative Mahoney.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Chair, I think it was alluded to that there's a federal... bureaucracy that deals with railroads, which thinks railroads are the best thing since sliced bread, so I'm going to guess that this would probably have a legal challenge to the ability to do something like this, which we, the state, would probably have to pay the legal fees at the Attorney General's. So I would, before we pass something like this, I would give us some caution. But the other piece is that I've had a couple of conversations over this. Railroads are at times arrogant and don't listen to people. And I think this shot across the bow might send you to court pretty quick over this whole deal. And if it doesn't pass this year and you don't come to an agreement, you might have it passed next year for sure. If it doesn't get through this year. For some reason or another, with even stronger and clearer language, because this is pretty clear, but it could always be clearer. I think this is a what we call up here a warning, more than it is something at the end of the day that's going to happen, but it might. Just telling you.
To the testifiers, one last question, then we'll vote. My understanding is that this issue, that there are a diversity and complex arrangement of these issues across different states with different guidelines. Is that correct?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, correct. This bill is very similar to one that just passed in South Dakota earlier this month. Governor signed it on the 14th, and very similar to one in Wisconsin. Okay.
So again, to the stakeholders, you're going to be going to transportation from here. My advice would be, even though you've been very candid in your deep-seated disagreements on this, that you please try to work together and at least find some areas of consensus and work on that. Representative Keel, do you have any closing comments?
Quickly, I want members to understand that in rural Minnesota, my cooperatives, my utilities are very important. But rail is also very important. It is, these are both two very important issues or facilities for northern Minnesota. So I want people to understand, I really hope that we can come to some agreement also.
Thank you, Representative Beal. With that, the Chair renews his motion to have House File 963 as amended, recommended to pass and referred to the Transportation Committee. All those in favor, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye. Opposed, say nay. The motion prevails. You're on your way to transportation. Thank you, Representative Keel. I'm going to be presenting Representative Hamilton's bill here. Is there someone from Fresh Energy to talk about this bill? So the chair will move House File 3353 be recommended to pass and referred to the Agriculture Policy Committee. The purpose of this right here is with regards to the energy components of this bill. So Representative Hamilton is not able to be here, but I've agreed to take action for him on this. There's a lot of subject matter in this bill that is not really relevant to this committee, but there are with regards to the site management guidelines and practices. It is related to ground-mounted solar. So if we could just have our testimony be very brief on just that component of it, and then we'll move from there. So welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair, members. My name is Rob Davis. I'm a director at Fresh Energy, an independent energy nonprofit based here in St. Paul. I'd like to acknowledge and thank Representative Hamilton for his leadership on this bill, and Chair for carrying the bill in his absence this evening. Chair, members, before providing my brief testimony, I'd like to just read a statement from Dr. Adam Burr, the Executive Director of the Minnesota Corn Growers Association, regarding this bill. Adam Burr writes, "The long-term health of our pollinators is a complicated issue, but creating habitat is a proven way to increase the likeliness of success. We encourage our members to look for opportunities to add habitat on their farms and have taken the small step of planting a pollinator garden around our own office. It makes sense for us to support House File 3353 because it's an easy and logical way to add habitat that is so critically needed, and add that habitat around solar panels, which are also contributing to a healthier planet." Chair, members, my testimony this evening will simply and very straightforwardly address agriculture and energy. On agriculture, about this time last year, we noticed that Minnesota would be building several thousand acres of solar sites. We sought for Minnesota to get more local benefits, soil benefits, water benefits, as well as food system and crop benefits from this significant investment and change. We discovered that in the United Kingdom, there is a very common practice to have native grasses and flowers and around and underneath solar sites. And not only that, but there's actually scientific data showing that the pollinators the bees and butterflies will increase in population as a result. We reached out to Dr. Marla Spivak, a MacArthur genius and a bee scientist here at the University of Minnesota, to see if this was actually ecologically significant, to see if Minnesota adding just a couple thousand acres would be significant. And she said emphatically yes, that a few thousand acres would greatly help bees and monarchs in our state. For perspective, the White House issued a report last year where one of the strategies they'd encouraged everyone to do was to plant pollinator gardens in their front or their backyards. By comparison, a solar site is usually several acres, and that compares significantly in a very different way to a backyard. In fact, 4,000 acres of solar, which is what we're looking at building this year in 2016, is just 1% or less than 0.01% of our cropland, it would be the equivalent of all of Minnesota's 1.5 million households getting a 6x12 pollinator garden. So we can help bees and pollinator crops at scale in a very simple way with private dollars and private investment. That said, every new market, every time we do something new, we need to come to agreement about terms. What does pollinator-friendly solar really mean? We can't have 46 different interpretations of what that is, and so we're seeking a common standard and a common definition for that language. Members, I would refer you to the information packet, and in there is two things specifically. One is our sign-on letter that includes a wide variety of business groups and agriculture groups that have signed on in support of this common voluntary standard. And two is a graphic showing exactly what a proposal like this would look like. It's very straightforward. It shows a solar panel with a variety of native plants underneath. And regarding that, on energy, I'd just like to comment and say that we've been contacted by NREL, the National Renewable Energy Laboratory, and they actually want to study everything we do here in Minnesota because they suspect, they know that solar panels perform better at lower temperatures, and they suspect that solar panels will perform at higher efficiency because of the coolness of the vegetative cover as opposed to being above gravel. Novel and interesting, and they're very curious about it. So this voluntary standard will help ensure projects provide real benefits to pollinators when they are promoted in that way. Thank you.
Thank you. Welcome to the committee, sir. Please state your name for the record.
Mr. Chair and committee members, my name is Ron Bowen, and I am the founder and president of Prairie Restorations Incorporated. I believe Prairie Resto is the oldest full-service restoration company in America, possibly the oldest in the world. We're not sure about that. We are an example, I think, of a burgeoning young industry. Prairie Resto is 40 years old, and so maybe young is a relative term here, but our business has grown to the point where we have over $7 million in annual sales. We have over 100 employees now. We are very actively engaged with corporate America, private residential, public properties, municipal, and others. So it's a very active industry. There are 10 or so real full-time businesses that do this along with us, and all of those businesses are prospering. So again, this is an opportunity in some ways to bolster our economic activity, and we very much endorse this. Of course, we think it's a wonderful ecological value, and the return on the investment is very, very positive.
Thank you very much for your mm-hmm. testimony. Are there any other members of the public who wish to testify in favor or voice concerns with the bill?
And Mr. Chair, I would just ask if you had received Representative Hamilton, the author's amendment to this bill.
Representative Hamilton and I talked about it, and he did not get it in before the deadline, but it's going to the Agriculture Policy Committee, so it can be amended there.
Thank you, sir. I have a piece of testimony from Eliza Clark, the Director of Sustainability at Anderson Corporation.
She actually provided written testimony to the members of the committee, so we have that already. Are there any questions or comments from members of the committee? Representative Wagenius, and then we're going to vote. Representative Wagenius.
Well, thank you for what you're doing. One of the things that I would suggest, and this was suggested to DNR Parks and Trails by Land O'Lakes, is to put these areas into drift watch. Had you all been thinking about that?
Yes, I know that there's been a wide variety of exploration of particular solar sites. Representative Wagenius, Mr. Chair. There's been an exploration of a variety of most efficient solar sites.
Do you know what I mean by drift watch?
Representative Wagenius, go ahead.
Yes. Do you know what I mean by drift watch?
Representative Wagenius, Mr. Chair, I'm not familiar with the term drift watch.
Representative Wagenius.
This helps aerial sprayers know where to go and not to go. You would register to the Department of Agriculture, and since we're in the business of protecting the pollinators, that is a suggestion straight from Land O'Lakes.
Representative Guineas, Mr. Chair, thank you. We will take that.
Seeing no other comments, the chair renews his motion to have House File 3353 be recommended to pass and referred to the Agriculture Policy Committee. All those in favor, please signify by saying aye. Aye. Opposed, say nay. Motion prevails, and the bill is on its way. Thank you very much. Members, here's the pathway for the rest of the evening. We're going to go with Baker, House File 3251. Mason is next at House File 3388. Mariani at House File 3559. And the final bill will be Garofalo, myself, at House File 2543. But I do have an internal curfew here, so if we're stretching on, we're going to start pulling bills from the agenda. Also, keep in mind, if anyone is here, House File 2689, the Daniels bill. Representative Daniels had a scheduling conflict. He's not going to be able to be here tonight. Representative Baker moves House File 3251 be recommended to pass and referred to the General Register. Representative Baker, is anyone opposed to this bill?
Not that I know of, Mr. Chair.
Representative Baker, to your bill.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair and members. I'm kind of the propane guy, if you remember my very first hearing back in Wilmer, Minnesota. Great place. And so it was... It's great that I can bring this forward. We're going to be very brief about... What's that? Yeah. Anyway, thank you. So anyway, we're going to make this very quick. Thank you very much.
Welcome to the committee, sir. Please state your name for the record.
Mr. Chairman, I'm Roger Leiter, Executive Director of the Minnesota Propane Association. We're looking to move this bill forward to give the Propane Council a little bit of leeway to increase its assessments that it assesses itself. We're looking at all the safety programs that they do in the state of Minnesota. It's a 501c3 organization, and you know, that organization has oversight through the Attorney General's office as well as Department of Public Safety, in particular the Fire Marshal's office, who we work with very closely. All the programs we do have a safety element into them for the safety of the people that use propane in the state of Minnesota. Our goal is to expand those programs to bring more opportunities, be able to do more inspections and safety programs inside of homes around the state of Minnesota. And that's, you know, that's the basis of what we want to do.
Perfect. Thank you. Are there any other members of the public who wish to testify on this bill? Seeing none, we'll close the public comment portion. Members of the committee, any questions or comments? Representative Baker, any closing comments?
Nope. Thank you very much.
With that, Representative Baker renews his motion to have House File 3251 be recommended to pass and refer to the General Register. All those in favor, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, say nay. Motion prevails. The bill is adopted. Representative Mason, you are next.
Thanks.
Representative Mason, do you have a author to, do you have a member of the committee available to move your bill? Representative Mahoney moves House File 3388 for possible inclusion in a later bill. Representative Mason, to your bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. And I do appreciate your consideration of House File 3388. And we all know that the challenges for small businesses are many, and particularly whatever their challenge is, dealing with all the regulations and rules, et cetera, tends to be extremely challenging. In Minnesota, we do have the Bureau of Small Business that does help with the journey. But even though we have that amenity and probably other resources as well, if people don't know about it, it's not helpful. Earlier, had you heard me earlier, we would have had somebody from the Bureau here. But my bill addresses specifically the Bureau of Small Business, and here to testify is a small business person, Dan Swenson. So I'll let him.
Welcome to the committee, Mr. Swenson. Please state your name for the record so that we can log it into the record, into the notes.
Mr. Chairman, representatives, thank you for offering me time tonight. My name is Daniel Swenson Klatt. I am the operator and owner of Butter Bakery Cafe in South Minneapolis. I've been in business for 10 years, including three in a new expanded building just a few blocks from my original space. If not for the support and the technical assistance of the Small Business Development Center, in this case the Metropolitan Consortium of Community Developers, I would not be here today. I, like many new business owners, had put all my personal savings, my dreams, my ideas, lots of research and energy, a BA from a small liberal arts college, all of those things into the startup of a business. I learned quickly that was not enough. Indeed, for many businesses, we do not make it past those first 3 years. I struggled to understand those vendor relationships, the health codes, the service contracts, the merchant cards. I was taken advantage of. I was given help from banks who sold me credit cards at high interest rates. I did get lots of credit, but I could not pay it back. After 3 years, I found help at a assistance center. At that point, I was told, you know, you've made too many mistakes. It's probably time to give up. I did not. At that time, I had also met with a community banker, and she directed me to a mentor at a small business development center. Together, we worked with a technical program that he had worked out, gave me the assistance, gave me the tools to understand my business. And through these past seven years, I've been involved in helping to grow my business from 9 to 22 employees. I've been able to move to a new business space and to expand. And last summer, after 7 years of working with my banker, received an SBA loan, which has allowed me to refinance those initial startups and begin paying them down. Over the past couple years, I have played the role of mentor to new entrepreneurs, have tried to hook them up to small business centers, to let them know what resources are available to them. And indeed, if the small business development centers thought that that would be useful in getting the word out, I would be one of the first to sign up. We talk a lot about equity these days. I think this bill offers one of the clearest ways to assist business owners with less capital, less education, less connections, and frankly, less privilege than I brought to the table. 3 years in is too late. Technical assistance and relationship building needs to begin at the beginning. Thank you again, Mr. Chairman and representatives. I urge you to support this bill.
Thank you very much. Are there any other members of the public who wish to testify on this bill? Seeing none, we'll close the public comment portion of the bill. Move to member questions and comments. Representative Mason, any closing comments?
Just that I really would appreciate your support of this bill. We know that there are a lot of people that have talents that need the help. And as our testifier said, they need the help early on. So that is what my bill is intended to do. So again, I'd appreciate your support.
Thank you again for being a job creator. I appreciate it. So with that, Representative Mahoney renews his motion to have House File 3388 laid over for possible inclusion in a later bill. Thank you very much. Representative Mariani.
Thank you. Have a good evening.
You too. Representative Mariani, thank you very much for your patience. Representative Mariani, do you have someone to move your bill?
I would ask someone to move my bill.
Representative Metza moves House File 3559 for possible inclusion in a later bill. And the A1 amendment is yours, Representative Mariani?
Yes, Mr. Chair, that's correct.
And Representative Metza moves the A1 amendment as well?
Yep.
Just get the bill in the form that the author would like. All those in favor, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
All say nay. Motion prevails. The amendment is adopted. Representative Mariani to House File 3559.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I got the message about brevity, so I've been cutting back my comments here as much as I could. Mr. Chair, members, today I announced with a coalition of immigrant groups from very many different communities a package of bills that we've introduced within the last week to really create a different positive, proactive vision in our state relative to our immigrant communities. It's basically a pro-immigration approach in terms of embracing these communities and what they have to offer to enrich our state. It's about building successful families, successful businesses, successful social outcomes with increased educational achievement and with increased public safety. This bill is one of those bills, and it's aimed at helping to produce greater economic development outcomes for immigrant small businesses. And it does this by investing in something that this committee already has ownership with, a program that exists at DEED with the competitive grant program. The bill itself requests a one-time appropriation, although frankly, I think the kind of work that we're talking about here really needs a deeper conversation about building it into the base and really growing that. And I think the reason for that is because these communities are continuing to grow. You know, we've grown our immigrant communities at a rate that's far higher than the rest of the nation. We still have a relatively small immigrant community compared to the rest of the nation, but our growth rate is really fast, which means there's some really great opportunities. And there's certainly a lot of interest in many of these communities in playing out and developing their entrepreneurial skills, not just here in the Twin Cities, but actually all over the state. And so it's a pretty good bet, I think, for us to be investing in that energy, helping them to create small businesses, which you all know are really tremendous engines for job development. So you already have the tool. You have the competitive grant program. This is about investing more in that, targeting it specifically for immigrant communities and doing that in terms of helping them with the technical assistance necessary to grow their businesses. The amendment that we added made it real clear that we're real interested as a state in building up the capacity of organizations that have unique skills and relationships with these immigrant communities so we can maximize our investment. And so I've asked Ms. Isabel Chancellor from the Neighborhood Development Corporation here, who's representative of one of those potential organizations that would compete for this grant, to come and just share briefly with you the nature of her work and explain the technical assistance component and the statewide scope of it in particular.
Welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record.
Isabel Chancellor.
Welcome, and please continue with your testimony.
So I would just like to share the technical assistance that we provide was really eloquently explained by the gentleman that just testified. However, the conditions are a little different for the immigrant populations that we work with, and that many of the nonprofits, the community development corporations that make up this ecosystem for entrepreneurship in the Twin Cities and beyond. We're working with folks who come here many times with degrees, sometimes not, but really do not have the assets of a house, vehicles, any of those things to really start their business. And many times, starting a business and employing themselves are really the only way for their families to survive, to earn an income, because sometimes the job market just doesn't accept the skills that they have at the level that they have. So we have about 25 years of experience serving many different populations, but we do about half of our lending, half of our training, half of our business services to immigrant populations, not just in St. Paul and Minnesota, but we have been invited by cities like Duluth, Marshall, and different places, Fargo, looking at immigrant populations there, helping people think about how to create incubators. We do a good job at Neighborhood Development Center of operating incubators, specifically ethnic specific incubators. And so this work is really involved very deeply with working with businesses, no different than big corporations who need a marketing team or who need an accounting team to get the work done well. We provide that team for these different entrepreneurs. We're there as their back end, their front end, helping them manage the businesses, helping them grow the businesses, and also helping them to sometimes get out of legal issues, sales tax issues, because there just isn't a lot of knowledge about a lot of these procedures and policies. So the work that we do in this system is very important, but also what the immigrant communities that are in business are doing are employing people, employing residents from their particular communities, providing opportunities for people to go up on in the ladder of job experience, and they're providing a lot of income and generating a lot of revenue for the state. So the work that we do is really kind of highlighted in the back of this flyer with the graphs. The work that we do is very important, but it's more than just really having access to capital that we do. We know that it takes training, it takes that business services assistance, what we call technical assistance, and it takes just a lot of hand-holding to get people to where they can grow and be on their own. And we definitely have many stories of second-stage businesses, businesses that have six locations, eight locations, have grown to almost 200 employees and who hire from their own communities and have really been successful. So we're very proud of the work that we do. We're very proud of the system in Minnesota that provides entrepreneurs this opportunity. And this is just another addition to that good work.
Thank you very much. Representative Mariani, do you have any other testifiers on this bill?
Mr. Chair, I don't.
This is a public hearing. Is there anyone else who wishes to testify on this bill? Seeing none, we'll close the public comment portion and move to member questions and comments. Any closing comments, Representative Mariani?
Mr. Chair, I hope that as the committee prepares its big omnibus bill, that it would take this proposal seriously. It's a good investment in Minnesota and a proven winner for us.
Well, it's great to see you again, Representative Mariani. And I like the new dude. It looks sharp. You're looking good. So. With that, Representative Metza renews his motion to have House File 3559 as amended laid over for possible inclusion in a later bill. Thank you very much, Representative Mariani, and thank you to our testifier.
Thank you. Thank you, members.
All right, our final bill on the agenda for today is House File 2543. The chair will move House File 2543 for possible inclusion in a later bill. Members, this is my bill that would eliminate, would add a eighth exemption to the certificate of need process that's currently under Minnesota law. What this would do is for those pipelines who have terminals that lie outside of the state of Minnesota, this would waive the certificate of need process. It makes no changes to the environmental aspects of it. It's particularly and focused specifically on the certificate of need. At this point, I would invite the test. We have, I think, an individual or two from Enbridge here. Want to come on down? Welcome to the committee. And for the record, before we start, I think it should be a matter of fact, we want to point out to members of the committee that you guys did not come to me and ask me to author this bill. I did this on my own, which I'm not really sure you appreciate, but that's your problem, not mine. So welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record.
Well, good evening, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. My name is Paul Eberth. I'm a project director for Enbridge Energy based in Duluth, Minnesota, and serve as the project leader for the proposed Sandpiper Pipeline Project. As you might be aware, Enbridge is actively seeking a certificate of need and route permit from the Minnesota Public Utility Commission for Sandpiper and for a replacement of one of our existing pipelines called Line 3. Our company has about 65 years of operating experience here in northern Minnesota. We currently have about 400 employees in Minnesota, and we operate eight liquid petroleum pipelines west of Clearbrook, Minnesota, and six liquid petroleum pipelines east of Clearbrook. We're all proud to live and raise our families here in Minnesota, and we value the relationship with the state and the communities that we work in. I appreciate the opportunity to be here and to share my views of our company's experience regarding the pipeline permitting process in Minnesota. And Mr. Chairman, I'm happy to take questions about our experience.
Sure, thank you. Ms. Cook, do you want to add anything?
Mr. Chair, no, thank you.
So just a question. So explain to us the purpose of the certificate of need. What is the value that this brings to, from Enbridge's perspective? What do you get out of the certificate of need, the regulatory process right now?
Mr. Chairman, we seek a certificate of need in order to gain permission to build and operate a pipeline. That's the purpose of our seeking a certificate of need for a project.
But in terms of whether it's economically feasible, whether you have investor interest, whether the facilities and capacity are needed for future planning, are these decisions that are made before or after the certificate of need process?
Mr. Chairman, those decisions are typically business decisions that we make before we seek a certificate of need. In the process of seeking a certificate of need, we have to demonstrate to the state that there is in fact a need for the pipeline, and we typically do that by showing that there's a market demand, such as firm take-or-pay shipping contracts, FERC-approved rates.
And so under the certificate of need that people in this committee may be more familiar with, they think of it as, for example, electricity power generation or transmission lines where there are dedicated service territories, and people may there may be an incentive for certain organizations to overbuild to create additional revenue. How does that apply to your guys' situation when you're constructing infrastructure?
Our customers are not residents, for example, the state of Minnesota. Our customers are really fall in a couple different categories. They're producers, they're refiners, and they're marketers. The contracts that we have with those customers are regulated by the FERC, Federal Energy Regulatory Commission.
Are your customers captive? Do they have a choice to work with you or to work with other providers?
They do have a choice to work with us or other providers. Okay. Although the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission does regulate the terms of service that we can provide on our pipeline, so we can't discriminate between different customers. So, for example, if we have available capacity on one of our pipelines and the nominations to transport on the pipeline exceed that capacity, we have to distribute it evenly amongst the shippers.
Understood. Thank you. The next testifier who signed up is Kathy Hollander. And then we have, is it Madison? Okay, so you'll be next. Welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record.
Hi, Kathy Hollander. I'm a
full-time volunteer with the group Minnesota 350, and it's a Minnesota chapter of the worldwide group 350.org, an organization building a citizens movement to address climate change. I'm also one of the founding members of Citizens Acting for Rail Safety in the Twin Cities. I've been active in the Certificate of Need process at the Public Utilities Commission for crude oil pipelines for about 4 years as a citizen. It's not a perfect process, but it does allow for orderly input from a lot of stakeholders. It requires significant resources, including time and money, from those of us who participate. I particularly speak on behalf of citizen input because it has challenged the process, I believe made it more robust, and is absolutely necessary moving forward. I also want to acknowledge a significant role that tribal input has played and continues to play in the process. A robust application for a certificate of need really allows for public input, like I said. It allows for transparency. It allows for nonpartisan, independent, some distance from direct political influence. It provides oversight of the need for energy supply to our state and our region. These pipeline projects involve clear-cutting and digging a wide swath, 300 miles times two across Minnesota soil, tunneling under rivers, through wetlands, wild rice beds, crossing three watersheds, and crossing the Mississippi River twice, and potentially establishing a brand new corridor across Minnesota. And also it proposed abandonment of existing older pipelines. The person from Enbridge just mentioned Line 3. Enbridge also has older pipelines called Lines 1, 2, and 4, for example. It is appropriate that scientific, tribal, and independent citizens' voices be heard because, especially, the declining use of refined petroleum products in Minnesota, in the region, and in the United States, and the effect these emissions of the products have on climate change. This is a huge project for Minnesota. It's important. It takes time, and we have an existing robust process, or an existing process which is orderly, through the Public Utilities Commission. It involves a written application. It looks like this. I don't know if you've ever seen them. As a citizen, I read through this entire thing. I've read through a lot of them. Sometimes citizens even find things that no other person has found in the application that help clarify the situation. I know I have to be brief. I would just like to say, until the public became involved, there was minimal review of these applications for certificate of need, and the application's word was taken at face value. The citizen input in the certificate of need process for pipelines at the Public Utilities Commission has provided for good governance through asking questions, through demanding clearer answers, through separating the applicant's natural self-promotion from facts at hand, through insisting that the law, including NEPA, be followed. I think this is extremely important, and I speak out for citizens. I also would like to say there's a very public decision-making process at the Public Utilities Commission. As the commissioners deliberate over their decisions, because of ex parte rules, they are not allowed to discuss the cases ahead of time, and we are all able to watch and listen to their complicated and thoughtful decision-making. And lastly, the power of eminent domain granted pipeline companies is huge, and predicated upon the common good. All citizens of Minnesota must have an equal chance to weigh in on the effect these pipelines have during the construction period and over their lifespan. We indirectly pay for their cost at the pump. We subsidize spill cleanup through our taxes. We live, hunt, fish, work, recreate, drink the water, breathe the air, and are being left with the oil that remains in the ground after they abandon their pipelines. Thank you for allowing public testimony about this bill.
Thank you very much. Mr. Madison, you're next. How do I pronounce your last name? I'm sorry.
Pardon?
How do you pronounce your last name?
Matson.
Okay.
The I is silent like the P in swimming.
All right. Welcome to the committee, and please state your name for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is Willis Matson. I'm from Osage, Minnesota. Thank you for allowing me to testify on this important legislation. By way of introduction, qualification, I grew up in a small farming community in northern Minnesota, Plummer, not far from the current crude oil pipeline corridor that traverses northern Minnesota's lake country. In fact, one of the Lakehead pipeline pumping stations was located in my hometown of Plummer. One of my brothers had a career working for Viking Natural Gas Pipeline Company as a station pumping operator in Warren, Minnesota. I graduated from Bemidji State University in another community located near the Mississippi headwaters along the same crude oil pipeline corridor. I hold a master's degree in science and have a 28-year career with the Minnesota Pollution Control Agency as a regional director in both Rochester and Detroit Lakes. The recent shale oil boom of North Dakota and tar sands development in Canada have spawned a spate of oil transportation challenges for Minnesota that are especially vexing, given that most of these new kinds of crude oil are much more problematic environmentally and are actually not needed here in Minnesota. In truth, with the lifting of the federal ban on exports, much of this crude oil may actually be destined for export to other countries. While energy projects such as these surely generate jobs and considerable tax revenues, Minnesotans are asking themselves the difficult question of just how much of their rich heritage of clean water lakes and virgin northern wetland resources should be placed at risk to accomplish these goals while facilitating the export of these highly hazardous new kinds of crude oil. Throughout my 28-year career with the Pollution Control Agency as regional director, most of my job responsibilities was to ensure citizens understood and had the opportunity to effectively participate in major decisions like this that affected the quality of their lives here in Minnesota. Since my retirement, I've continued to volunteer in the same capacity and now found myself advising and advocating for landowners and fledgling citizen groups in northern Minnesota as they attempt to navigate the complex statutes, rules, and procedures set up for crude oil pipeline proposed in their water-rich regions of the state. I think I understand Representative Garofalo's concerns for what appears to have been a faltering along the way of the state's existing permitting and review process for these projects. Citizens groups I've been working with have struggled to find their way through this process as well. Citizen groups recently succeeded in clearing the way for some of the procedural confusion with the Minnesota Court of Appeals ruling that helped everyone chart a clearer path forward. This appeal court ruling resolved the seeming conflict between two bodies of state law and rules by declaring that the Minnesota Environmental Policy Act actually charted the correct path forward. The citizen groups, state agencies, and even the pipeline company all apparently now agree that the path forward is clear, and the relevant state agencies are now well on their way to toward answering the difficult questions and making the final decisions on when and where the current pipeline projects should be constructed. I would urge the committee to support citizens, agency, and the company to ensure the projects now move forward efficiently, objectively, and transparently on the path they're now on. I hope the author and the members of the committee will find that the solution offered by the proposed bill, HF 2543, is no longer necessary because the path forward for these pipeline projects is now clear and acceptable to the parties involved. I would want to comment with regard to the significance of the certificate of need that the testifier before me pointed out, that with that certificate of need is granted the awesome power of eminent domain if and when it's determined that these projects are in fact serving a public purpose. So it's a critical, important decision to be made and not taken lightly as to whether or not this facility is in fact serving a public purpose, not only for Minnesota, but maybe for its neighboring states, as we place our resources at risks. And the power of eminent domain is a powerful tool that is actually imposed on landowners along the route who may be unwilling to have their land used for this service. So it's important that it be determined that it serves a public purpose. So I think it's a key element to the certificate of need process that's now being served. With that, I'd be happy to answer any of your questions, and thank you for allowing me to testify on this bill.
Thank you. Are there any members of the public who wish to testify on this bill? Seeing none, we'll close the public comment portion. Mr. Grant, you want to testify?
You started it. Shut up.
Welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Bill Grant for the Department of Commerce, and thanks for the opportunity to share our concerns with House File 2543. First concern is that this bill would treat pipelines differently than other large energy infrastructure projects, except those subject to a state mandate. It would deprive the public the opportunity to understand the need for such facilities and associated impacts. It would deprive the state the opportunity to assure that such facilities are not duplicative and to condition such projects to protect the state citizens and its natural environment. Finally, Mr. Chairman and members, if the purpose of the bill is to save time in the permitting process, I'm not sure it would accomplish that, since such projects also require a routing permit from the Public Utilities Commission. Such reviews are typically done concurrently with certificate of need, meaning that no time would be actually saved on the calendar in awarding a permit for a project such as this. So I'd be happy to take any questions you have.
Thank you. Are there any other members of the public who wish to testify on this bill? Thank you. With that, we'll go to member questions and comments. I'll have a question from the gentleman from Enbridge. If you could come back up and walk us through the there's line 3, line 67, and Sandpiper. Try to walk us through the original timeline and then walk us through the timeline of where we're at right now.
Yeah, so I think you mentioned three projects. We have Sandpiper, line 3, and then our line 67 project. I can start with Sandpiper. That is the project that I've worked on the most. November 2013 is when we applied for both a certificate of need and a route permit. Those applications were deemed to be complete in approximately February or March of the following year, so 2014. In June of 2015, I'm sorry, there is one other noteworthy point. In September of 2014, the Public Utility Commission on Sandpiper made a decision to separate the certificate of need in the route permit process, stay work on the route permit, and only process work on the certificate of need permit. And then in June of 2015, the Public Utility Commission voted unanimously to approve and issue a certificate of need for the Sandpiper project. Then moving forward, Mr. Chairman, in September of 2015, the Court of Appeals remanded the certificate of need back to the Public Utility Commission to perform an EIS, an environmental impact statement, stating that because the certificate of need and the route permit had been bifurcated, MEPA compliant environmental review had not been done. And since the certificate of need rules don't specifically call out a certain form of environmental review, the Court of Appeals said that the default review should be an environmental impact statement. So that's where we came to as a late 2015. Moving into this year, the Public Utility Commission rejoined the certificate of need and the route permit. In addition, they solicited comments from parties as to what form of environmental review should be done to support decisions made on the route permit and certificate of need. Enbridge, along with I think all the parties that are formally a party in the proceedings, recommended to the Commission to perform an environmental impact statement. And we are now just getting started on the environmental impact statement for Sandpiper. The timeline for Line 3. Line 3 filed its application. I don't know the exact date. I don't have it in front of me, Mr. Chairman, but it was in the summer of 2015.
And again, this is the pipeline that right now you guys are operating at a lower pressure, out of concern that there may be that at a higher pressure it could rupture and there'd be a problem, correct?
We do operate Line 3 at a voluntary pressure restriction.
Okay. And so you guys are proposing to upgrade the infrastructure to make it less likely to have an oil spill?
We've proposed a project to completely replace that, right. That existing pipeline.
And is that pipeline subject to the requirements of a certificate of need?
We believe it to be. We are proposing to replace the 34-inch pipeline with a 36-inch pipeline. So since there's a slight size difference and we are proposing to take a slightly different route for a portion of that pipeline's lay, we believe it is subject to a certificate of need.
Okay. Thank you. Any other questions from members of the committee for this testifier or other testifiers? Representative Wagenius.
Thank you. I just need to understand a couple of things. One of the testifiers said that the pipelines crossed the Mississippi in two places. Would that be both above St. Cloud, or would it be between St. Cloud and Minneapolis-St. Paul?
Mr. Chairman and Representative, we have let's see, six pipelines across the Mississippi River in Bemidji, and then we have six pipelines that cross the Mississippi River near US 2 at approximately Ball Club. And the proposed pipelines, Line 3 and Sandpiper, if built along their proposed route, would cross the Mississippi just south of Bagley, Minnesota, and then again near Palisade, Aiken, Minnesota.
Confirms that, we'll get yes.
Yes. The reason I ask this, members, is because about a million Minnesotans, more than a million Minnesotans, drink Mississippi River water, and that would be people in St. Cloud, and people in Minneapolis, and people in St. Paul, and some of the suburbs in Minneapolis and St. Paul. And that million people doesn't include folks who go to the airport and drink water. It's just a million residents. So we have not really talked much in the state about source water protection for the drinking water for over a million people. And so this is one of my concerns, is this crossing of the Mississippi or of being parallel to it where oil could get into the Mississippi. So a huge concern I have, which brings up my next thing. Is it the certificate of need, or is it the EIS, or both, that require the alternatives process that allows the look at alternative routes?
I think it's actually the route permit, but we'll go to the testifier with that.
Mr. Chairman and Representative, there are alternatives looked at really in the case that we're talking about in three different stages. So there would be route alternatives looked at during the route permit process. There are alternatives that are required to be looked at through the processing of an environmental impact statement. There are also there's also a requirement to look at alternatives in the certificate of need rules. So there's potentially some duplicateness that takes place, but there are alternatives in all of those stages.
Representative Legadius.
Well, that's I think something that this committee needs to think about, because we are talking about source water for a million folks. And I don't know the different rules for the certificates. My guess is that that in each one of them, when you talk about duplicative, that you can actually, I mean, I know a certificate of need would look at, do we really need this, all this energy?
Right.
But the alternative route is really an important piece of this puzzle that we all haven't talked about, because we're not the committee that has to worry about drinking water. And so I think that's probably my biggest concern about the proposal you have, where we should, at the most upfront point, look at drinking water. The other thing about the drinking water issue, just because of the way the metro area is expanding and because of the problems in the White Bear Lake area, it is becoming more and more clear that not only will more people be on the Mississippi because there is ample water there, and not so much groundwater, we're depleting it too fast, but we'll probably need another drinking water system right on the Mississippi. So we'll have Minneapolis, St. Paul, St. Cloud, and probably one of the suburbs lower than St. Paul. So this is major. Drinking water, people get this. So that's my concern, Mr. Chair.
Yep, and we should at some future point, we can talk about the lack of a certificate of need, a route permit, or an environmental impact statement for the virtual oil pipeline of rail cars that are now going through the state, above ground, crossing the Mississippi River, and many other waterways. It'll be a different conversation for a different day, but there's, for that virtual process of a virtual pipeline, None of those things apply. Representative Fabian.
Can I respond to
that? Sure, absolutely. Representative Guinness.
Well, actually, I think we should have that conversation. There are potential, just as and Representative Baker isn't here, but as the in Wilmer, they're going around the city. That was smart. We have the potential to go to reroute all the things that are coming into Minneapolis. There is that potential there. We haven't discussed it, but that would keep us from going across the Mississippi so many times. Now, where we go across the Mississippi in Minneapolis, it's actually way below our drinking water intake, and it's way below St. Paul's, surprisingly enough, water intake, because the water intakes for both cities are north of Minneapolis.
Representative Guinness, are you suggesting that oil is safer, a safer alternative for the environment to be transported via rail as opposed to a pipeline?
I am saying all I'm saying is when you talked about crossing the Mississippi in Minneapolis, that is below the drinking water intake, and just wanted to add that in, way below the drinking water intakes.
Representative Fabian, and then Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm just curious. Obviously, the Line 3 is a big issue in my district, Kitson County and Marshall County and so forth. The economic impact to our small rural counties with regards to tax revenue from pipelines is extremely significant. If I'm not mistaken, I believe that the number one, the highest source of property tax revenue in those two counties is from pipelines that come through there. And I think that it's important, and you touched on it, Mr. Chair, but it's important for people to realize the Line 3, with a small exception, is simply a replacement of a line that has kind of met its life expectancy or soon will, and now we're just not changing the footprint, we're just replacing a pipeline that you could make the case that soon is to be not safe, and we want to put a new high-tech pipeline in the ground. Is that correct?
Yes, that's correct. I mean, Line 3, as it operates right now, we believe it to be safe. I mean, one analogy you could use is, you know, if you had a 1999 Ford Taurus, you know, we don't necessarily have to take them off the road, but if you replaced it with a 2016 Ford Taurus, I don't think anyone in this room would argue that it wouldn't be safer. So, I think your description is correct. You know, our plan would be to decommission the existing pipeline, take it out of service, and use a new pipeline.
Yeah, but it would still be a Ford. Yeah, Representative Fabian.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And then to the point of Sandpiper, again, it's a big issue in terms of revenue, in terms of safe transportation of petroleum products from western North Dakota to Superior and Duluth, and then eventually on to Chicago. I am concerned that if Minnesota... Well, I've been on the environmental review and permitting stuff since 2011, my first year in the legislature. Our processes are painstakingly slow from my perspective. Can you give me some idea of what the processes were in North Dakota, or maybe South Dakota, or Iowa, or Illinois, or Wisconsin, to get to the point to where you start the process and you have the permits in hand to start laying pipes in the ground in terms of timelines?
Yeah, I can give you an example, I guess, in the case of Sandpiper. In North Dakota, a permit called a corridor certificate, so it's very similar to the route permit in Minnesota, is needed in North Dakota. That process took approximately a year. You know, it was similar in scope to the things that we go through here in Minnesota. It does look at alternatives to the project in general and looks at the route and does a very robust environmental review. You know, like the robust environmental review we'll do here in Minnesota. In the case in Wisconsin, a permit is not needed from the Public Service Commission in Wisconsin unless the company is seeking eminent domain authority. And in Wisconsin, we were able to acquire all of the easement necessary for the project and therefore do not need eminent domain authority in the state of Wisconsin. So we had made a permit application there, and we have since withdrawn it. The other permit that's needed in Wisconsin, significant permit that's needed in Wisconsin, then is for routing the pipeline, and that's issued by the Department of Natural Resources. does require an EIS in Wisconsin, environmental impact statement. The draft environmental impact statement has been published, and we're waiting for them to complete the final environmental impact statement. The process in Wisconsin takes probably slightly over a year, maybe closer to a year and a half.
Representative Fabian?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just one quick follow-up on that. And how many years into the process are we in Minnesota with regards to Sandpiper?
Thus far.
We applied for a permit in 2013, November 2013.
Representative Fabian?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And then finally, the people who are potentially the most impacted by the pipeline are the people whose property that the pipeline would cross, obviously. Can you tell me, from my perspective, what percentage of agreements do you have with landowners along the proposed route for Sandpiper? What percentage of those agreements do you have in hand with those landowners along the route?
Chairman and Representative Fabian, we have about 95% of the easements that would be needed for the project acquired in the state of Minnesota. You know, we've been on the ground quite heavily working with those most affected, those landowners whose pipeline the project would cross. But it's also noteworthy that there's been numerous public meetings, public hearings led mostly by the Department of Commerce that we've participated in for the permitting activity. And we want, I think, like all of the stakeholders here, you know, a robust review of the project, robust environmental review of the project. Like Willis Madison said, you know, we have alignment to do an environmental impact statement. What we value, though, in particular as a company, is predictability in the process.
Thank you.
Representative Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and to the testifier. Now, I don't hear that you're not opposing the doing a certificate of need. Is that correct?
We're here neither in support or opposition. You know, we, as a company, want to apply the law that's in place and use the process that's in place. Again, you know, we do value that robust review.
Representative Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. How many barrels of petroleum will be going through the pipeline, just to have some sense of scale on a daily basis?
The testifier.
Mr. Chairman, Representative, we have, we move, I'm going to talk about it in a couple different phases. We move around 2.5 million barrels a day through our pipelines in northern Minnesota. On Sandpiper, it would be moving approximately 375,000 barrels a day through the portion east of Clearbrook, approximately 225,000 barrels a day west of Clearbrook.
Representative Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And then the EIS is underway, and you're about to proceed with that. My only thought, Mr. Chair, is given the fact that if an EIS, when the EIS is completed and it's determined that the Sandpiper is needed and alternatives are look like, it just seems sensible to me to get as much public input from as many stakeholders as possible where it's proposed to go, since it's going through such sensitive areas, and to do it right. And I think that's what the certificate of need would do, would help determine where the best location of such a pipeline would be. So thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Mahoney.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. To the testifier, I'm not sure which pipeline this bill would apply, but you say the pipelines are old, 30 years old, 40 years old, whatever, and only a pipe fitter will ask you this question. Can you explain what type pipe you is in the ground now? And what type pipe you are expecting to replace it with in terms of your schedule and the metal makeup of the pipe?
Mr. Chairman and Representative, I appreciate the pipe fitter like question. The first pipeline that was installed in 1949. All the pipelines are steel. Early on, the material was an X52, a 52,000-pound yield-strength steel. Today, we're installing X70, so a 70,000-pound yield-strength steel. Probably the most noteworthy differences in the technology around the pipe is in the coating technology. So in particular, the Line 3 pipeline was installed with what was called tape coat. And that type of coating technology.
Does everybody run one of those Jeepers?
We should all practice jeeping pipe. So the tape coat technology has not held up as well as maybe some of the coal tar technology that was used before it, or the fusion bond and epoxy technology that was used after it. So in particular, the pipelines that were installed with tape coating have experienced higher rates of corrosion due to the disbonding of the coating material.
One more question.
Representative Mahoney.
One more question. I want to make, I'll probably, can you explain in layman's terms the difference between the pipe joints, the wells on the pipe joints from 1940 to the wells on the pipe joints in 2015?
The testifier. You could just say they're better.
You know, there is improved technology being used in the welding, but Mr. Chairman, Representative, I'm going to take you maybe to the next step, and that is probably the weld inspection.
You don't X-ray every weld, do you?
We do X-ray every weld. Yeah, 100%.
What's the inclusion rate? How much can you leave in there out of your welding rod?
Mr.
Everett. Mr. Chairman, Representative, API 1104 has different sizes for different types of defects. Our defect rate is, when we weld today, is somewhere around the 3% range of welds that actually need to be repaired. But I think what's most noteworthy in your previous question is welds were not inspected 100%, in the 40s, 50s, 60s, in fact, at a much, much lower rate. Probably the only inspection that was used at the time was a pressure test to see if it burst.
Yeah.
Representative Mahoney.
And I'll just explain why I asked that particular question is because nowadays, if you have a dot about the size of your pin, you get a fail on your on your weld, and you have to go in and repair it. And this 40-year-old line, let's just say I'm not the best welder in the world, and I would have no problem making that weld. It's all downhill, red rod, really nice and simple to put in. Today's welds are a lot different, and the pipe. This is all Canadian. Most of it is Canadian sand tar. That you would be putting through the new line.
Yeah, that, Mr. Chairman, Representative, the Sandpiper pipeline project is proposed to move oil out of the North Dakota area, so the Bakken area.
Oh. That's almost sweet crude.
Correct. It's a light sweet crude.
I don't know. I don't think the testifier has sufficiently demonstrated knowledge of pipelines to us committee. So, Representative Metza, that was a joke, by the way.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I am impressed with the knowledge of pipelines tonight. Actually, I was wondering if we could potentially waive the midnight rule. And well, I think there's a very important discussion that you brought up, and that was in regard to your comment about Fords. As a proud Ford owner, I know where you're going, and I believe Tesla makes a good car, but there's nothing like a Shelby, Mr. Chair.
All right. Anything else before we go? Representative McGuinness.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you for your good knowledge. One of the things that we discuss in this committee when we talk about electricity going over wires, et cetera, is security. We have to think about people who want to interfere, mm-hmm. I mean, for sport or for evil. Tell us about how do we know a pipeline is going to be secure? What do you all do?
Well, Mr. Chairman, Representative, not to be too funny here, but some of that stuff we don't publicize for the.
Sure, I know that, but tell us overall what you do.
And so we do have a control center that we keep in a quiet location. So, for example, our employees, unless you work at the control center, are not allowed to go there or are told where it is. So, I mean, that's one example of the security protocol. It is a very, very high-tech control center. In addition to that, we have a completely second and redundant control center. And just to describe what a control center is like. I mean, it's much, much larger than this room. You know, it operates like maybe an air traffic control center, if you could picture one of those. I have had the opportunity to go there because I did work for a while as our director of safety, and our you know, I had an employee that worked in the control center. We have monitoring. We monitor the pipeline with aircraft, in addition to having our control center operations. It is monitored 24/7 through our control center as well. That's so those are some of the things.
We're supposed to say that you built a wall around it and you made Mexico pay for it. That was the correct. Representative Gaines, I really want to end the conversation, but I have to tell you, I'm fascinated that you're concerned about the security of a pipeline. And I'd be curious how the security of rail cars with oil would be better than the rail pipeline.
I'm concerned about both, Mr. Chair. So we need to be discussing both.
Right. Representative Fabian, you're chomping at the bit. Are you ready to go? All right.
Mr. Chair, two things. I have a couple of former students who are welders, and they weld pipes together. And they're asking me, what do we need to do to speed up this process? We just want to go back to work. Good union jobs in northern Minnesota. And the pipes are made out of steel, and I think that we do have something to do with the steel industry here in the state of Minnesota. Thank you.
All right. Thank you for your testimony. Great knowledge. I appreciate everyone's testimony and patience. With that, we are adjourned for the evening. Thank you.